we all agree on that. But how does that reflect on the care that's given to the mom?
Okay. One of the major concepts in maternity care and elsewhere is that you want to have balancing measures so that you don't push too hard in one direction to the detriment of another direction. And here, maternity care, you have two patients, the mother and the baby. And one of the concerns, for example, with trying to reduce cesarean section rates is that you may end up with worse babies in the process. Or any of the other interventions that we do in obstetrics, really, we have our eye on what happens on the fetus, but we haven't had a measure to go with that. So it's a balancing measure. Are we doing more or less things to the mother that may advantage or disadvantage the baby?
Nancy?
I have a question. Speaking about the cesarean rate, if you're doing, we have a high incidence of cesarean, it says in here that you see babies now at 38, 39 weeks that end up with respiratory problems because of cesarean section. Okay, I understand that. But according to this data, if you come in and your baby gets a respiratory problem, aren't they excluded?
No. That's one of the numerator where there's both TTN, RDS, and all the procedures that go along with being on the ventilator. A chest tube, for example, non-invasive ventilatory codes are also included.
So all of these, on 2A.3, all of those are included?
Those go in, again, it's the framing of whether it's healthy or ill. So those, if you go down to the measure calculation, those are in the numerator.
Okay.
That excludes you from being healthy.
Basically, what he's doing is he's identifying the number of kids who have one of these complications, like TTN or respiratory disease. It comes up with a number or a percent, and then subtracts that from 100%. You know, so basically presents, so what's important is he comes up with either 0.5% or 2% or 3% of the population, but presents it as 99.5 or 97%.
Okay.
So you still have, the challenge is identifying that percentage, that small percentage, and then it's a question of marketing or presentation or what families want to know as to whether you present it as that 2% of kids have a problem or 98% of kids come out just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to be sure that I understand that everything that you've basically included in the definition of a not healthy newborn, you believe is preventable or avoidable by changes in maternal care. Is that correct?
There were a couple of topics that are debated, The neonatal group that we work with, the CPTCC group, that is basically an offshoot of Vermont Oxford, and our group looked at these very, very carefully. For one example that I said before was brachial plexus injury. The ARC excludes that, though that is a major morbidity for a baby. It can be prevented if you do a C-section. It is not always, it does not, if you have it, it does not mean that you did malpractice, though, and that's why in some measures it's been excluded because people thought, well, you can do perfectly normal or perfectly adequate obstetric care and still get a brachial plexus injury. From the patient's perspective, though, that was an unexpected outcome. And it is a significant outcome that, you don't have a healthy term newborn if you have a baby with a brachial plexus injury. And that was the philosophy that we ended up choosing to use in these borderline cases. Balanced by trying to exclude as many diagnoses that were present in fetal life before we get into the measure itself, by excluding those from the denominator.
I just, and so you I asked that question when you mentioned TTN, so I assume that there's a way that TTN can be avoided.
Sure. Most TTN, the most frequent cause by far is C-section without labor, where you don't have the squeeze on the lungs from labor, and you have often a little bit of early gestational age involved, 37, 38 weeks, or 39, as opposed to 40. And that has that is a 3 to 4-fold increase rate just from that occasion alone. If the question, you know, our goal is 100%, but no, there's no center that will get 100% on this measure. There will always be something that sneaks through, but there's big variation and big opportunities for improvement there.
That's a good question. I had a question. I was a little confused about your definition says that it's identified term singles and infants, and yet you said this would be sensitive to this issue of, quote, late preterm births, which is, of course, the most important to the increase in preterm.
The term is that we're really focused on is the early term, the 37 to 39. That's the focus of actually the big project we're doing with the March of Dimes right now on prevention of early preterms, which we think is going to spill over into the late preterm population.
So I guess again I agree that's a critical or the critical thing to be addressing. It feels to me there are more direct ways to address that, like, you know, measuring the proportion of infants that are born less than 38 weeks or something like that, which might be do we have that measure already? Okay. I was going to say, this seems like a rather broad brush to use to attack that specific thing that should be addressed. So, okay. Alan?
Yeah, I have two questions. One is how you deal with intrapartum fever in the mother and whether those are excluded or not. And the second is, now that you've excluded so many of the things that cause neonatal morbidity and mortality, even 150% difference among institutions, what is the effect size of that difference? In other words, does 150% really mean anything?
Sure. Let me do the last one, and I'll go back to intrapartum fever. We're talking the differences between basically 1% and 3%, or, you know, a little over 1% and a little less than 3% of the population. So that's still a significant effect size. When you get into term babies, the biggest proportion of morbidity is in congenital anomalies. But there's still a fair amount of morbidity of babies admitted to NICUs, which in a sense this is a surrogate for. Babies admitted to NICU and have other morbidities that don't quite get you into NICU still accounts for a real number of cases. The trouble with anomalies is that there isn't really much we can do at this point to prevent them once they occur. We are all giving everybody a lot of folic acid and taking that route. But prenatal diagnosis doesn't actually cure your anomalies unless the family chooses to terminate. So that's a very different population, a very different issue than what we're dealing with birth issues and how you manage labor and delivery and its consequences for the baby. In terms of fever, that's one that the expert panel has worked on a fair amount. There's very large variation in how infants are handled in normal nurseries around the country. We're most familiar with California. In terms of what kind of workup the baby gets after the mother's had a fever in labor. And it goes from observation to IV antibiotics. And it's quite interesting that there is not a lot of difference in outcomes when you actually look at those. So we're looking at encouraging mothers in labor with fevers to get aggressively treated in labor, and that does appear to prevent a lot of the neonatal outcomes. So there is the ability to affect that. Now, what's included in our numerator or in the quote exclusion set is babies that actually have sepsis, not babies who have got antibiotics. That gives the obstetrician a opportunity to have that intervention in at least some of the cases where IV antibiotics to the mother actually can significantly reduce the infection sepsis rate in the newborn.
Yeah, I think if this really becomes widespread, that it may be one of the first things, if not the only thing, that would reverse the trend and increase cesarean section rates. I don't know, do you anticipate that, or have you actually seen any evidence of that since you've been using it?
Yeah, that is one of my directions. I'll have to put that out. Because actually what you would like to have is a good rate of good babies and reasonable rate of C-sections. And right now we have C-section rates that range from 15% to 50% in hospitals in California. There's that much variation there, and everybody's doing it to have good babies. And I don't think there's that much you don't get that much additional benefit, if any, on the baby side for those kind of variation in C-sections. We have been following in Sutter Health, which is, again, 25 hospitals in Northern California, some variations of this, and that includes APGAR scores, for example, five-minute APGAR scores. And that has been part of our basket and has moderated our C-section rate quite significantly. So we are way below the state average and the national average. It still has increased. I can't claim it's flat, as I lead the OB quality efforts there, but it is much below the national and the state rate. And I think that's, you want to have data like this to really, you know, show what your outcomes for your babies are, your term babies are. We have focused a lot on neonatal outcomes on prematures, you know, survival rates for under 1,500 gram kids and so forth. But we haven't really had much attention or measures looking at term babies. And that's what this would fill the gap for.
Can I just ask what the drivers are of these rates? I mean, do you have one or two? No, not the C-section rates, this performance measure. Again, you've got lots of different codes that can get in there, but I'm trying to see basically, is it the TTN for the 37 to 38 weekers that's driving, 80% of the variance here, or is it everything?
When I look at composite measures, you always have to look at which components have the biggest frequency within, i.e. which drives the code. And it is respiratory is the main one. Birth hypoxia asphyxia is probably second or third in there. First would be respiratory, second would be infection. The third would be hypoxia asphyxia.
And
in smaller hospitals, it's transfers of care. You know, where you have to transfer the baby out to another facility. That's part B on this schema. That's a major dissatisfier and a major negative for families to be put in that position where they're separated from their baby in the newborn period. Go ahead.
Let me just observe that that's very interesting in that it correlates perfectly with the top expenditure codes in the Medicaid program. I mean, there are four or five different categories in which expenditures for these kids fall that are pretty high. Those highest in the respiratory distress area. Nancy, you had a question.
I had a comment. I think you asked about, I don't know about since this measure's been out there, but there's several studies across the United States with people in hospitals reducing the C-section rate, especially if I can think of one right within Akron, Ohio, and they talk about reducing the C-section rate by making sure that you have a protocol for induction and that the people buy into it and stuff like that. And in Washington, we're also working on that, but we're just taking that measure, not something this big. And I was wondering the advantage over this, because I believe LeapFrog is now going to start collecting information, too, on C-section rates and in what we call late-term babies, 38, 39 weeks. I mean, late C-section, what they call.
Yeah, the risk adjuster, or the low-risk term C-section rate is actually a measure from our institution. It's an NQF measure that's now a Joint Commission measure. And as we use that and implement it around both in systems and states, the obstetric pushback is, what about the babies? We think it's fine to do C-sections, but we want to be sure we have good babies at the end. And that's one of the drivers to have this as a balancing measure. I think the second measure that you mentioned, the elective delivery prior to 39-week measure, either by C-section or induction, is a very important measure and will change clinical practice. That's just measuring the frequency of births at that time period. And it's going to be a very important measure, as I said. This will allow us to say that we've actually improved the outcomes for the babies at the same time.
I was saying, yeah, we have the measure. What I'm saying is that we're doing something about the number of C-sections. It's the same thing as that we've got a couple of hospitals that have a 50% rate for C-section. They're small hospitals. The average rate in Washington is 33%. We know that, and we know we need to reduce it, and so we have five pilot projects going about looking at babies born at 37 weeks and do things about induction. So we have the numbers. We're implementing something, and I guess what I'm saying is, why is this measure better than what's being measured out already?
I don't want to respond for Elliot, but I served on the perinatal steering committee, and we debated the C-section rate measure endlessly. and I think that we need both. The C-section rate tells you you've got a rate that seems way out of line. As I understand it, what Elliot's trying to say is people advance in support of a high C-section, the danger of an unfortunate outcome for the baby. This measure is designed to give you some sense of, I think as Elliot said earlier on, if you lower the C-section rate, is your rate of that baby going to go up? Am I sort of right?
That is the fear that's out there in the community. There's medical legal risks. There's all kinds of risks out there in terms of babies. But the reality is the C-section rate has gone up. We haven't the outcomes for babies has not changed. Has not improved with higher C-section rates.
No.
But we don't have a measure to really show that. And so it's a complementary measure that allows you to put into place those QI projects on C-section and have it be the safety measure that shows that you are not doing harm. In fact, you may be actually improving neonatal care by having a more moderate C-section rate.
And this measure doesn't, if I were thinking, this measure doesn't weight different complications differently.
No, we decided not to do that. is that inherently subjective one way or the other?
Yeah. No, I'm not arguing with that. I'm just thinking of the countervailing argument when, you know, when you reduce C-section rates and you reduce then presumably the respiratory complications, there may or may not be, but probably there won't be, there may or may not be some small increase in some other kinds of complications, which was the rationale for C-section in the first place. I think we've actually had a great conversation about this. I suggest we could move on to voting, unless there are compelling questions. I don't see any. So I'd say the first threshold question is whether this is important enough for us to proceed. So why don't we have all those who believe this is sufficiently important to proceed to show of hands?
Complicated.
Great. So then let's move on to the discussion of scientific accessibility. We've had a fair amount of conversation about this, but I don't know, Elliot, if you have any comments or are there questions from any of the members about validity, reliability of this measure, and the various other elements of scientific accessibility. We feel that it's adequately been addressed.
People do need lunch.
Okay, but we're not prepared. Any questions about scientific acceptability of the measure? People feel good about it. Okay, so those who feel it completely meets the criteria for scientific acceptability, so Pam.
Ten.
And partially meets? Next is the area of usability. And again, you've said you've done a fair amount of focus group work with this and efforts to communicate it.
And it also is a straightforward administrative data set with ICD-9 codes. So that's the gun I'm under in California, is that it has to be, new quality measures need to be using the administrative data as much as possible.
And can you describe any use in your collaborative or at Sutter or Kaiser or any of the other places in terms of how providers have experienced this measure and how it's contributed or not contributed to quality improvement activities, et cetera?
We've used earlier versions of this extensively in the Sutter Health as the parallel to our C-section quality improvement efforts and our oxytocin quality improvement efforts. We are starting the elective delivery under 39 weeks, and we'll probably go with that. But it has been both a source of reassurance and, you know, it changes the focus a bit to say, okay, what can we do to optimize the baby outcome as a focus? So it's been the safety measure that goes along with the other quality improvement measures directly.
And is there any evidence of improvability? That is, I know there's variability across sites. Have you seen within single sites any trend data on...
We have seen trend data both for the components of respiratory and infection. We've been pretty good on hypoxia asphyxia as bigger categories, as the third of the big three categories. So we haven't seen as much there. But there are places around that have higher rates. I just haven't, we don't have quality improvement efforts there to show improvement. But certainly for the respiratory complications and for infections, there is opportunity.
All right, so in terms of usability criteria, those who feel it completely meets the usability criteria?
Eight.
And partially meets?
Okay.
Good, and then feasibility, which is the one that does specifically get at the issue of availability and administrative data and ability to collect and generate reports and all that sort of stuff. So how many feel it completely meets the criteria for feasibility? call for a measure on to recommend endorsement of the measure, and this one would not be conditional or time limited. This would be endorsement of the measure to go forward. It's a regular measure of the right. So all in favor of recommending endorsement?
Great.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I guess it was worth getting up at San Francisco time. Good. Thank you very much.
Okay. We're going to move on to our next measure. It's measure 48. And I hope we still have folks from AMA-PCPI on the phone who've been waiting for this measure.
Hi, this is Carrie Fai. I'm staff from the AMA-PCPI, and we also have Dr. Barbara Feibusch, who is our co-chair.
Okay. So, again, this is measure 48. The title is Plan of Care for Hemodialysis. This is the percentage of calendar months during the 12-month reporting period in which patients aged 17 years and younger with a diagnosis of ESRD receiving hemodialysis have a single pool HP over V greater than, or have a single pool with a documented plan of care for an adequate hemodialysis. So I'll allow you guys to kind of explain that. Sorry, I butchered the description a little bit.
Oh, no, you did fine. Did you want me to give a little brief introduction or?
Sure, that'd be fine.
Okay. So we developed this measure, I think, about 2 years ago after we had developed the same measure for the adult population, which was actually developed prior to this one, wanting to have the same measure to for the pediatric population as well. So really, there's really not much difference between this one and the already time-limited endorsed adult measure, which is actually we just gave testing results for, and I think we'll be going to the CSAC sometime next month for potential full endorsement. We did provide the testing results from the adult measure. We have not had the opportunity to test the pediatric measure as of yet. So really, Dr. Feibusch, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yes, just because this is a highly specialized field within a field. So we're really talking about a small population of patients, probably in our country maybe 800 pediatric patients maintained on chronic hemodialysis, but it's a very vulnerable population in that it has a fairly high mortality rate, which we're trying to address in other ways. But there is a gap in care here in that we think about 12% of patients from previous data sets have not met what we think is adequate dialysis, and that is measured by a KT over V, which looks at the way urea moves during a dialysis process, and to simplify it. So we have good evidence that a KT over V of 1.2 is a dialysis prescription that is adequate, and it's really a minimal prescription. We have linked a low KT over V to poor outcomes. We have a high mortality rate, and we think this is an easy-to-capture measure. It's reported on a monthly basis. Conditions of coverage. Dialysis units can easily get to this number and send it to us, and we'll be able to closely monitor how patients are being dialyzed in the country that are pediatric, and hopefully we'll be able to use this data long-term to really link it to more long-term outcomes. This is an intermediate outcome. The measure is both a process and an outcomes measure in that we're looking at a standard of 1.2, but we're additionally looking at a thought process that if you're not dialyzing a patient well enough, what would you do to change that? So we think it's a good combination measure that's going to give us important information in a vulnerable population that has a high mortality rate that we think is easy to capture.
This is Charlie Homer. Could you explain again why it's an outcome measure rather than a process measure?
Karen may want to help me. I guess an outcome measure, and I maybe
we are
looking for KT over V of greater than 1.2. So we are looking at an outcome specifically, but we're looking process as well. And Carrie, do you want to clarify that?
Sure. It's actually, the measure is actually a combined process and outcome measure. So when the measure results get reported out, you're going to have your patients who, you're going to know your patients who meet the outcome, and for the patients who don't meet the outcome, that they have a documented plan of care. So the user of the measure would get all pieces of the measure reported back to them. So you'd have patients with a single pool KT over V greater than or equal to 1.2, patients who have a KT over V less than 1.2 of the documented plan of care, and then patients with a single pool KT over V less than 1.2 who don't have a documented plan of care, which would be your measure failure.
Can you explain KT? I mean, it's a long time since I did dialysis or nephrology. Just for layman's terms, what a KT over V is?
Yeah, it's urea kinetic modeling. It's, as I briefly alluded to before, it's really the movement of urea and how well you're clearing it from the body over the course of the dialysis procedure. And we use that as a measure of adequacy with the idea that if we're moving urea, we're moving other molecules, you know, through the process of dialysis, and that if we're dialyzing someone well, the movement of urea is going to result in a higher urea kinetics modeling is going to result in a higher KT over V than if we do not. So higher would mean more dialysis, either longer dialysis, a different cartridge, higher blood flow, but it would indicate when you look at KT over V, the higher the number, the more dialysis a patient is receiving by measuring the way urea moves.
So can you help us understand why a patient would not have an adequate KT over V and why the measure wouldn't just be having an adequate KT over V as opposed to if you didn't having the plan?
I think, you know, it seems that it would be simple to just dial up the dialysis and to make everybody have a KT over V greater than 1.2. It's hard for me to speak to specifically why people wouldn't try to do that, and my assumption is they would. But there are patient characteristics and catheter characteristics that lead to the inability to dialyze patients adequately. For example, in the pediatric population, one of the things we do think is a problem is that most of our patients who are chronically dialyzed have external catheters as opposed to internal fistulas or grafts. And so they have a higher risk of infection. We're trying to move in that direction. But if you have a catheter, you may not get the best blood flow. There may be recirculation of blood within that catheter, and you may not be able to adequately dialyze this patient. So there are some factors, and then there are some patient factors about their ability to tolerate how we dialyze them. If we are dialyzing them three times a week and trying to move fluid, we may be unsuccessful. They may get hypotensive during the procedure. We may not be able to do what we'd like to prescribe. So maybe that's a patient who would have a KT over V on a single session of less than 1.2, but the nephrologist would be bringing them in for a fourth treatment a week. Another plan of care might be to change the access in the patient. Another care of plan might be to try and change blood flows by changing the way you actually expose the patient to sodium. So although it sounds that it would be easy to dial in this many hours and this many patients, we can't always get the blood flow rates we want. We have recirculation. We have patient vulnerability. They can't tolerate how long we want to dialyze them for. So sometimes to get to that 1.2, we have to be creative. We have to put thought into it. We may have to change an access. We may have to work with the family to and our surgeons to move towards a better access, and we may have to do dialysis more often, differently, and that is allowed in our care plan to say, well, you know, we're going to change this, we're going to do this access, we're going to change the rate of the flow, we're going to consider more frequent dialysis, we're going to change a different dialysis, we're going to change our modality. It just gives us the ability to address the fact that it, although it sounds very easy, and I will just use the example of when we talk about target hemoglobins and we say they should be 10 in our patients, and we can give them a lot of erythropoietin stimulating agents, and many times we can't reach that 10 anyway. So there are just patient variables that prevent us from always getting to the adequacy that we think is needed. And the care plan will let us look at what to make sure that physicians are addressing an inadequate KT over V when they see it.
Is
I just wanted to echo what Kathy's concern as well. I think with only 800 children going through hemodialysis, I'm concerned that the numerator, the number of patients who don't have a documented plan, is going to be very, very small. And what constitutes a documented plan? It sounds like it would be complete lack of recognition that the KT over V was less than 12. I mean, if somebody wrote down, well, increased frequency of dialysis, would that be adequate? And if the standard of 1.2 is so well accepted, it's hard to imagine too many physicians not documenting something to that effect.
I think until we look at this, I mean, we've looked at KT over Vs through the CPM data set. We've been fortunate that the government, because although the pediatric part of the ESRD program is not Medicare, the adult part is. So we've had scrutiny for a long time in data collection, and we know there is a gap in care, in terms of KT over V. I'm not sure we know why yet. And this measure will allow us to better understand practice patterns.
Right, and I understand there's a gap in KT over V. It's the documentation of plans that I'm not sure there would be such a big gap.
And I was wondering what the evidence was of relationship between documented plan of care and better outcome for these patients.
Well, as I said, in the United States, we have a very, very high mortality rate in the first 6 months of patients placed on hemodialysis. It's about 22%. It's very high, and it's high in pediatrics as well and going up, but probably not that high. We've never really been able to capture this data looking at individual physician practice patterns. As we've looked at it in the CPM, it's been looked at more as it's not even being broken down regionally because the cells are too small. But I think it is important, as we improve care, to start looking at this as a physician measure to see if there are practice patterns that can change. Because clearly there seems to be, in the literature, the suggestion, I know we're looking at intermediate outcomes in our patients. I mean, attainment of a dialysis prescription is an intermediate outcome. It's not a true outcome. But there is in the data evidence to suggest that meeting these intermediate outcomes results in mortality and decreased hospitalizations. But it is a complex, it will be a complex analysis because there are other intermediate outcomes that we have to meet as well. I mentioned the hemoglobin before, but there are nutritional outcomes. There are a lot of intermediate outcomes we have to meet, but this is one that we thought we could target, start educating physicians about the importance of this measure and its linkage to mortality, and additionally to start having them submit their care plans, because I think that is critical to start thinking about how people are addressing it.
I think that's just the piece that I'm having a hard time understanding, not the physiologic outcome, but that a documented plan of care will lead to that physiologic outcome.
Sometimes, I guess I think as a physician, because we get licensed in the state of Maryland, certified for our dialysis unit on a yearly basis here, we have to write care plans. Most states do not have yearly licensing of dialysis facilities as we do. So they may not be licensed or certified for 7 to 10 years. But we write down a care plan for every patient that doesn't meet standard targets here. And it actually, I found it has, and we've looked at our numbers over time, it's driven quality improvement. Because if you continue to report that you have 2% of your KT over V is less than 1.2 or 5%, and you have to justify each 6 months what you're doing, it has really started to not just dialing it up to dialysis, it's really pushing our unit, for example, to start using indwelling lines to move away from the external catheters, which is critically important. So I think looking at your numbers and reporting them and looking at your inadequacy in dialysis is actually, and documenting what you're doing about it, is going to be very important for driving improvement.
I'm sure that that's correct. I guess the question I still have is, first of all, there's general issues about composite outcomes, but this is even more complicated because it's a composite outcome and a process outcome at the same time. And so just to state it in the extreme, if there was one site that met the outcome
by having all the patients meet the physiological outcome, and another center who met the outcome by having none of the patients meet the physiological outcome, but have all of them have a documented plan, I do not consider those two to be equivalent. So it almost feels to me like you're trying to have all the sites like look fine or be able to achieve 100%. And I think it's the variation. And then to your point, the steps they take to achieve the 100% of the physiological outcome, which is actually the relevant outcome. And if there are intractable patient factors that make it much harder to do that, then that becomes a need for risk adjustment for the outcome variable, as opposed to adding in the process, at least the way I'm hearing this.
I think, one of the things that we can do when we're moving towards, when we have those types of difficult patients, is to move to more frequent dialysis, which is a move across the country. And again, I think if we will, you're right, the way that you stated it clearly suggests that those outcomes would be equal, but I think those outcomes are not equal, and I agree they're not equal. But the way they'll be reported back to the physician will include which of their patients had what adequacies and how many were over 1.2, but how many weren't over 1.2 and had a care of plan. And I think clearly having a care of plan and not having an adequate dialysis means that that's something that needs to change over time. You have to figure out a way to have adequate dialysis. You can't continue to just report that you're trying. So I think it is going to be very valuable as it's reported back to people, because they're going to see those numbers and that detail. If we just left it as greater than 1.2, I think as just an outcomes measure, I think we wouldn't be giving an opportunity for the kind of improvement we're hoping to see, because in many patients, it's going to be difficult to get to the 1.2 because of the factors we've discussed. I think when we started the conversation, if it was easy to achieve a 1.2 in everybody, I don't think we'd have a gap of 12%. So, but I agree with your points. They're very important, that it clearly is not the same to have 10 patients who have met your KTOV of 1.2 and another unit has 10 patients who have not met any adequacy measures but have plans. Those would be very different outcomes.
Ms. Holbrook, I just want to weigh in. Having lived through the first round of the interview measures in 2007, this is essentially, just correct me if I'm wrong, the same measure with a different level. It's 1.7 for adults. It's 1.2 here. Yes?
No. Okay, it's the peritoneal dialysis measures. That's 1.7. The adult hemodialysis measure is also 1.2.
Right, so we are really aligned with that adult measure.
And you will, and with this measure, you can have a rate reported out of patients between 1.2 and 1.7, and that was done through the administrative coding for the adult measure as well.
I guess my question was trying to understand: is there any reason you couldn't potentially take the initial measure that's already endorsed and just extend the age down to children?
We did talk about that. However, the plan of care definition for the pediatric measure is just a little bit different than the adult measure.
The measure and have that information in there. It just doesn't necessarily seem like, if it's really very, very similar, do we really need another measure in this case? My second point is just that when we went through this the first time, we had a lot of discussion about this exact issue that you're grappling with today, of adequacy of dialysis and plan of care. And one of the requirements that came out of the process was that the expectation was the measure would be reported with two rates, that you'd be able to see the adequacy of dialysis, and then you'd be able to see, if not adequacy of dialysis, is there a plan of care? And I just want to be sure certainly we would hope to be internally consistent as best as we can do that. So that would certainly be the expectation for this one as well. I just want to make sure that that's your understanding as well.
Yes, and that's how we have it set up.
So it really is, in essence, two measures under one, or at least reported as two linked paired measures in some sense. And again, is there an assessment of the adequacy of the plan, or is it simply they have a plan? And how does that work?
I think we put down in our descriptor there are various plans that we would consider acceptable. and we listed examples of plans that we would feel were acceptable plans. So I think, right, the level of, at this point would reveal that there was a plan. But it's Arnold language is a little different than the adult language in what is an acceptable plan.
I'm trying to be a little consistent with some of our earlier conversations when we gave another group a very hard time about the categorization of preventability or not, things like that. So is the idea here that all the plans would come to a single place who would make a judgment based on criteria as to whether a plan is adequate or not? Or is it, and again, I may have missed in the specification, so how will you be judging the adequacy of the plan?
I don't think through the use of the measure we'd be able to judge the adequacy of the plan. It would be that there is a plan of care in place.
Okay.
But, in the definition, we have a definition that of what the documented plan of care may include.
It may include any of those things, and
correct.
If it doesn't include any of those things, but says, you know, I don't know, I'll see them back more frequently, or I'll call the mother to make sure he's doing okay, or something like that, or less frequently. We talk about the importance of a written care plan, so maybe that's kind of similar to what we're talking about here. But to be honest, there's also at least a little bit of evidence of that case.
So is it just a dichotomous variable? Is it either there or not? And then along with that, I was just wondering about your CAPA statistics. Then it looks like it ranged from 42% all the way to 93%. And I guess it appears then that there might be some differences in definition of whether there's an adequate plan of care.
That's really...
I'm sorry, there's a lot of static on the line, so it's hard
for me
to hear.
The question really was what the reliability of the assessment. There was a CAPA statistic that's presented that has a pretty low bottom number of 0.4, is a pretty wide range, and didn't know.
Right, and the CAPAs are from the testing of the adult measure.
Okay.
And what really, through that experience, what they found was that at different sites, the manner in which the plan of care was documented was different, found in different places, or not present at all. So it could either be, or it was in either the physician office or at the dialysis facility, depending upon where the physician was seeing the patient.
So, Ellen, you had a question.
Yeah, it just relates to the plan of care specification, and I'm drawing a parallel, as you did, Charlie, to the children's asthma care measures, which actually has components of what should be in the plan of care. And that has problems of its own, but I'm wondering, you know, if you've looked at that and if it would be possible to get a little bit more specific around what must be in the plan of care in order for it to be adequate.
So instead of saying a documented plan of care may include, saying a documented plan of care should include. I think looking at our plan of care and our measure, I don't think the reason we didn't say should is because, for example, one of the things that could be in a documented care plan would be increasing the blood flow or increasing the dialyzer size. And that's not possible for some patients. They may not tolerate that. So if we say should, we can't say should, because the same should, we could say if the patient was big enough, it should. But we can't say that in a patient who's hypotensive, because that would make the patient sick. And that's one of the problems we had in creating the measure. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly we should say a documented plan of care should include documenting residual renal function, because we can, that's easy. But many of the things, we can't say that's the way to fix it. We can't say, for example, changing the access, because it's possible that that patient isn't a surgical candidate for a better access. So I think there are things that should be in a plan of care, but I don't think we could standardly say they must have this in the plan of care, because that wouldn't allow for any patient variability. You know what I mean? The patient, per se, couldn't have a better access because they had sort of used all their blood vessels. The patient couldn't tolerate a higher blood flow. Those are all really very real scenarios.
Just once again, in the interest of simplicity, I know you've addressed this. If you just switch to a simple KP over V measure up and down, is there any reason to think that some of those other factors, children with poor access, who are distributed any differently across the country among those 800 patients? I mean, you're going to get those people everywhere, so as a quality measure, wouldn't it be simpler just to switch to
the... Well, I would say the other thing that we don't know precisely is this is the pediatric measures we talked about, but we're not sure how many pediatric patients are dialyzed in adult facilities. We know that we can tell something about provider types, but in a study that we did several years ago trying to figure out how pediatric patients were dialyzed and where, it seems that at least one-third of children under the age of 17 who are dialyzed chronically are dialyzed by an internal medicine nephrologist. So we're not sure, as we go forward, if practice patterns are different regionally, if they're different based on provider type, if they're different based on if your care is in a pediatric unit versus an adult unit. I think we will find out some of that information when we start looking at a physician level measure that we don't have right now.
Can I just ask if most of the issues of, you know, essentially patient factors that make it impossible to achieve the goal, is that only in the little babies? I mean, is there a way that you could perhaps not go down all the way to zero here and get rid of some of those challenges? Or else, I guess, alternatively, create an age stratification or a risk adjustment by age or size?
Well, you know, one of the things about this, you were just talking about the simplicity, it's not a large population. When you try and take out or look at the small children, you end up going into more and more subgroups and losing your ability to look at children, although clearly the babies, the infants on chronic dialysis are different than the adolescents. But I think that even knowing that it is harder in an infant, I still think we don't think it's acceptable. And in fact, it's probably more important for younger children to have adequate dialysis if we were going to say where is it more important because of issues in growth and development. So I wouldn't want to take out the infants, even though there aren't many, and say it's okay, we're not going to look at how you dialyze babies. Because if people are doing dialysis in young children, they all need to be very aware of their adequacy. I agree, it is hard, as it is in all pediatrics, we're dealing with different patient issues as children grow. And certainly there's an impact on growth of this in terms of access we can use, blood flows we can use. But I still think we need to look at the youngest children because they probably are the most vulnerable patients.
Last comment, and then I think we could probably move to voting.
Okay. Just before I vote, clarify that there will be some determination about where the care takes place.
What?
I'm thinking about university centers and where they are all, let's say, intensive research-oriented university centers versus, let's say, private facilities that might be in rural areas, for example?
Well, I think we'll certainly, because this is a physician measure, I will be able to find out who's providing care for these patients. I don't know that we'll be able to tease out at this level yet. And, Carrie, you can help me with that. I don't think we're trying to. This will probably also go in, we're hoping, as a facility-level measure as part of the new clinical performance measures. But they don't have physician-level measures for us. So hopefully, if we can get these measures in place, we'll be able to address that very important question. Who is the primary provider? Is it an internal medicine nephrologist or pediatrician? And that may really have no difference. We don't know. And where is that care being provided? In a hospital unit, in a freestanding pediatric unit, in an adult unit that takes care of children, in a private practice facility? I think those are very important.
All right, so I would suggest this is very helpful that we move towards voting on the measure.
Have we decided whether this is indeed an outcome measure or a process measure?
But I think my sense is it's a combination that the KT over V is an outcome measure,
it's a
fair measure of both outcome and process.
So it meets our scope.
I think it would fit within
any outcome, like a composite measure that included outcomes within, so I assume a paired measure that included an outcome would be within scope too.
Okay, so voting on the importance of the measure, remind me the criteria for importance.
Importance measuring
important impact
variation to outcome. Okay, so clearly in terms of relation to outcome seems strong. We've got for that KTV, it's challenging because we've got one where I think we have a lot of confidence in the relationship between media and outcome. But okay, without more editorializing, let's vote to all those who believe it meets the importance criteria. Those who believe it does not meet the importance criteria.
Got it.
Next one is the scientific acceptability of a measure. How many would believe that it completely meets the criteria for scientific acceptability? How many feel that partially meets the criteria for scientific acceptability? How many believe it minimally?
I'm a nun.
Okay, I was going to say, I'm saying no, I'm missing one.
Next one is the usability of the measure. Everyone remember the criteria, the elements of usability?
Sure.
Understand what it means, and they can take action on it.
Yeah.
So, again, understandable harmonization of value. And from a harmonization, just simply the point is there is an adult measure that... And understandable, I think we should view this again as a paired measure. That is, it's not, it's really reported as two different components of the measure rather than a single item. So how many believe it completely meets the criteria for usability? I believe it partially meets the criteria for usability.
Okay.
And minimally meets the criteria for usability? And not at all. All right, and then feasibility. Again, data is a byproduct of care, electronic inclusions, and accuracies in implementation. How many believe it completely results? How many believe it is partially feasible? How many would be minimally feasible? Not at all. All right, and then why don't we move to an overall recommendation? I think this would clearly be a time-limited, given that the adult measure is time-limited, and with conditions that would relate to what conditions would we want to put on a... Do we need to? Or?
I don't remember any conditions.
Well, if we want conditions related
to... conditions, I heard one had to do with age stratification, one had to do with specification of the elements of the self-plan, more like in one detail.
If again, and not that, and this is where, just as a comment, it's not that we would be dictating what the plan is, but that it needed to address those elements.
I thought age stratification wasn't possible because of the smallness of it. That's what she said.
If we want to see the data reported, I would suggest we'd like to at least potentially look at that. It may be impossible.
What I heard her say, maybe she could say what she said instead of what I heard, is she did not want to exclude the babies. But that's different than reporting the results by age stratification or risk adjustment by age of baby.
Right, I'm the she. I think I'm sorry, it's Barbara Five-ish. I think that was a very good summary of, I didn't want to exclude them because I didn't want to lose the importance of them, but was concerned about the numbers. We could report it out that way and see how it looks.
Okay.
There's no way for us to do what was suggested is extend the age group under the adult endorsement.
Sounds like they said the plan of care was different.
I think the plan of care was different. And the other thing is we really have specified in our measure, in our numerator, and please tell me this. I know I've already had an opportunity to speak, and I know you're all been working hard. I just will quickly say the other difference is we want this to be a single pool KTFV, which means it's precisely measured at a certain time after the douse finishes, as opposed to the adults who are less concerned about when they measure that KT over V. And that has to do with body size in pediatric patients and the way things may rebound from the cell to out of the cell. So that was the two things that came up about harmonization. I think the measures are very close, though, and it's possible, that over time, or if we get time-limited data on this, we could really think about harmonization. So I don't want to say that's not – those were the issues with the harmonization when it came up earlier, but I understand that harmonization can be very valuable if we can do that.
And my understanding – so I'm just thinking of advantages or disadvantages to be having a single – having this an extension in age group. Nephrology dialysis is covered through Medicare on the CMS side, so even one reason we sometimes would like to be under the common element would be because we want CMS to emphatic to use this. But in this case, although we know CMS is paying increasing attention to the Medicaid side, and this would be consistent with their long-standing emphasis on Medicare quality. So by having it a separate measure, does not decrease the likelihood that CMS would use this.
And I would just point out that these patients are Medicare eligible, but one of our problems is that often they their parents may have other insurers, so they're not necessarily covered by Medicare, even though they could be covered by Medicare. And that really ends up making it difficult for us to just enter a Medicare database and see claims and reporting. That's why this is a great opportunity, for an additional reporting system that we can perhaps see this information with Medicare supporting the concept.
Okay, so again, I think the vote is for a time-limited endorsement with the conditions that Kathy so well articulated. All those in favor of a conditional, a time-limited endorsement with the conditions that were mentioned? Measure did not pass. Anyone want to reconsider the vote? We can't even know. So, okay, the measure didn't go through as is. I do want to thank the stewards for presenting the measure, and I do look forward to I would encourage you nonetheless to continue to collect these kinds of data and bring it back.
for your interest in the plan as well, that we're planning a ESRD CKD project starting in the late summer, early fall. So if any of this input makes you want to think about a new submission, that would be a good time.
Great.
Yeah. I'd love with to see. Nephrologists to understand
what is key to the research. And I'd love also to see an ongoing learning collaborative amongst these institutions that share these patients, and then we could actually see whether you could refine further the issue of this plan. But that would be outside the scope.
Well, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to present, and it's a moving target. I think we're all trying to improve care, and we'll just continue measures. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and take a very brief break for lunch. If you could take maybe 10 to 15 minutes to come back, and we'll have to reconvene. We are adjourning around 3 o'clock, and we have about 6 more measures to go through. So,
okay.
So one, 13th Street.
Oh, that could be a problem, but it's actually security.
Community Health Center and Refugee.
You can also try.
I'd like to talk.
We actually talked about that.
And how do you manage the mental health issues and aggression?
Many things today have been more, I mean, more clinically in my realm, so a little more
used
to talk about hard casts and teeth surgery. And stuff.
Husband didn't always have this.
That OB stuff, I don't know. And that KTV, I was thinking, uh-oh, I'm out of my seat.
Well,
my ex-husband was an OB.
Medical
for a while, and was a candidate. OB,
front CD,
of getting the hip top, the cars.
You tell me your ex-husband was from the Twin Cities?
Yeah, he was from the Twin Cities. No, he's in Mankato.
Oh. What's his name?
Larry Larson.
That must be cutting off.
Is he, who's he with? From Mankato Clinic or Mayo?
I think he works for Mayo, but
he is not.
I'm reading in the paper, the headlines here, a bomb series.
Medical assessment.
At the airport.
Simon.
Oh, really?
Cleared it already, though.
I've been there before when someone took off and then they pulled you back out of it, put Dad out of where the satellites are, put the little trail on the hotel. I think you're really related to that.
Psychiatric nurse practitioner?
We do not.
How do you spend me out?
My body does not know what time zone I'm in. I left here last night. I went into Macy's. And after I didn't buy that super bronco. And then I went and I turned on the TV, fell asleep. No, I got something to eat downstairs, and I was really disappointed because it said shrimp skillet. So it said shrimp, smoked sausage, rosemary, roasted potatoes, and garlic, and then a corn in a cup. So the skillet came out. There was no smoked sausage, no rosemary on the potato that looked like they were boiled rather than roasted, and no garlic.
Wonderful.
Oh, I'm sorry, it had shrimp in it, but the shrimp was.
What did you do?
I said the Hyatt. Well, the, and then the, well, this bistro has really odd stuff. There's some really good phone, but anyway. The waiter came back, and I said, isn't it supposed to have rosemary and smoked sausage? And he went to check, and then they brought me a separate order of smoked sausage. And then about still eating, then the chef came out and talked to a few people and came over to me. I said, how expensive? I said, well, with the smoked sausage, the rosemary, and the garlic missing. Other than that, it's fine. So. Yeah, I should have followed Donna. She's making the rounds of the restaurant, so I should have talked
to her. Donna, where did she go?
I don't know, it sounded like she really enjoyed stuff before.
Yeah.
I couldn't get over thinking about how I grew up in Ohio and what I eat now. And even what's more interesting to me is to go to Hawaii and see my girlfriend.
And the diet she's on is totally different, you know. Mm-hmm. And then she went, she says, I'll go get some food, you know, we'll go over to the park. And we got there, and she says, we don't have any chopsticks. So she's just going to, so she walks up to the Filipino family to ask if they have extra chopsticks, and they did. And I thought, you know, it's a good one.
Yeah. We have a family.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
The discussion.
Uh-huh.
And there's a huge Filipino.
Oh, yeah. And,
no, but the two of them.
A lot of the cooking is very different. Their isolation is more
than the most. Well, we had a little Filipino shack around from where we worked, so we had some food. But when I went over there and she said, oh, get this, and she said, don't get this for Nancy. Will she like it? Yeah, yeah, she'll like it. I said, I like everything but koi. But anyway, I have to say now I have other things to add to it since I went to China.
Yeah.
But anyway, you're right. I mean, it was huge and really good. The thing I found here is that there's some really good restaurants in Bethesda. I think when it's an Asian restaurant, I just kept my mouth shut. And I thought, I got spoiled in Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
It's really bad. My mother stands and watches me as I have to pack.
I'm in the process of moving.
Are you?
I'd love to have you come.
How that upset me. It's not healthy, I don't think.
But yeah. It's getting done.
Yeah. Well, most of the kitchen's unpacked.
Yeah.
Last night I kept unpacking boxes. I had to find one lamp.
I had to have a lamp for my process measure.
They're,
packing a bunch of stuff. You need all the stuff you need.
It's a very good.
Yeah.
Right, very good for the bad thing. Asian restaurant. Vietnamese restaurant. I should say something.
Nice relationship between that.
Food. Owned by Vietnamese and it's French cooking. It's very good.
Well, she really didn't describe it.
No, she's not.
But, you know, lots of Thai restaurants.
Uh-huh.
And it was really interesting. I went into the hospital. Going crazy.
Oh,
my girlfriend.
Phenomenal.
Chinese.
And you're leaving a little early.
No,
I don't take any chances with that.
Since the bringing
that little cat coming in,
it's comforting for her.
Really.
I
really
might not want to ask anybody else.
She brought some mask.
Okay.
And I was not doing well. You know, the smell.
The only thing I had so far.
So I thought, this time I got to find some because I don't want to insult her. And she says, what do you want? And I said, what?
So you opened it up
and
put
in
the hand.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
She brought
enough.
So I opened it up and put in the hand.
But that's super. Oh, well. She brought enough of that I had two helpings.
Yeah.
Here, two helpings.
Okay.
And we must have fed the staff on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So the bad thing is that I've
actually... Wait, they
It's not pretty. We have this. Oh, I do that all the time.
I think my disappointment, I can't hear one. I went to a restaurant that worked in Georgetown that was supposed to be the best Italian restaurant, but they had a theme.
Oh, let's go to Westwood.
I don't know.
And so I came here. So you go upstairs. I mean, I'm looking for Italian food. We had a choice of plain old spaghetti, salmon. Now, I'm not going to
want
salmon here. I think it was some other chicken. So they looked at me, and really what I got was spaghetti and meatballs, and I do better. I was so disappointed. Because the lady said, don't you want salmon? And that's my son from Seattle. I came here to eat Italian food, you know.
I know.
Okay.
Now, I have at least four or five pairs of
the tractor has a
big deal. Political running restaurant. Cheesy Bros. The National has a regular station.
Oh, wow.
You know, I feel like it's not such a
popular thing. How much for that?
How old are they now? Where is he going to go to school?
Oh, I love that. I'm very excited.
Environmental science. The other thing I go looking for, at least Seattle is a good Jewish military. We did that to get better when I was in Houston.
We used to have a couple of them in the Bethesda area.
There is. It's going to be a new world.
I felt sort of bad. I walked up when I first went there 30-some years ago to Arnold Mikulski, and I said, now don't take this the wrong way, but I'm looking for a good Jewish delicatessen, and he said, there isn't one.
Movie school at USC, huh?
No. He has a friend.
Where'd you go off with? I was in Flushing. Oh, I was 12, then moved up to Westchester.
You could probably tell, though, by the time she's already got that pathway, so you can tell. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, don't worry.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's not my water. I don't know. Oh, okay. I thought David, he had water, and I thought he left it.
I just started to smile when I saw it.
That's a cute little one. What is it? Nothing.
Years ago, I was on a cruise.
Oh, yeah, you have more, thank you.
One of the cruise. He had a few stories to tell.
How many questions do you have?
Well, at the moment, it's
oh, I was reading it. Okay. Spending the work.
Especially about really actually hard to deal with what I had to do it before noon.
Well, that was true. Okay.
How
long ago was that?
About 4.5 years.
Oh, okay. So you're from the States for a while and then go back?
Yeah, my boyfriend is American.
Okay.
And he went back to retirement.
Okay.
If you're retired, he works for the government.
Yeah.
So I'm out in 10 years and I'm like, okay. And then we go.
Okay.
Several nights away.
How are you from?
I'm going to give you a personal question.
Oh, I know.
Retirement's in 10 years. Okay. Oh, so.
Yeah, I was actually.
Yeah, okay. You started early then.
Right.
Then, since I've taken
Manipulated very well.
Yeah, he just tried something different.
Yeah, I mean, he said that he would consider a school boy.
And I'm sorry, I asked you where you were from tonight, and I didn't hear anyway.
I grew up near Fishville.
Okay.
Like the Black Forest and the Village Border.
Yeah.
Very easy. I have to try and miss it once in a while.
Yeah. My sister's just my My dad is second generation.
So I guess we're having them look at the other.
They forgot they were
10. And they'll have to decide out of all of them which one. That'll be the challenge. Do you know what I mean? So out of all the 22, which ones think are appropriate as a default. I don't know.
And then I was interested. She was looking for investment.
But see, out of the 22, they've already reviewed 10
debts.
Yeah. I get that. So I get that.
Right.
You can see.
I mean, it's really the sort of the spoken language that you have.
Right.
And that's usually where they're at.
Okay. It's sort of like talking about dialect. This is Japanese. We just learned English about it in the South.
It's very difficult to figure out where some U.S. people are based on how they speak. For me, sort of, then I could say they come from Chicago or they come from New York, except for the I don't
Introduction
measure.
Like, from this
town, so yeah. There's a...
If they speak correctly, For me, that's what it means.
Helen and the woman there is supposed to be from Israel. And when she's not picking up the, or they're giving a hard time about it, is all the idiots. She has her language, don't beat around the bush. Yeah, and I didn't realize that. Didn't get some cough drop.
Oh, Let me show you where to go.
It's Peter.
We don't want anything.
Yes, how much Peter?
I actually took some children, one of my best friends out to dinner last night. Went to a very good restaurant. OIA. It was an Asian restaurant. It was just cool. Yeah, it's not far from the Hyatt. It's about 10 blocks away on 9th Street. And but one of those where I go to a restaurant and I ask them, can I sit in a quieter place? Because it's loud. It was very loud, but the food was great. Kids were very interesting. Young adults. One was for
NASA.
One was for NASA.
Well, Marina is getting a little bit of food. I think we could probably get started. And I'd like to ask the. All right, the measure that we're going to be addressing next is the Validated Family Centered Survey Questionnaire for parents and patients' experiences during inpatient hospital stay. If I got that correct, Nancy, are you okay?
She's still sitting upright, so.
Still sitting upright. Okay, sorry. I just want to make sure you're okay.
That's what I was asking.
How the hell everybody?
Does she have a nib?
I got this horrible virus. I've had all my flu shots, okay? And then after it, I hadn't had this happen to me since I was in medical school. I got bronchitis with an asthmatic component, okay? Or some people say you have reactive airway disease. And then I'm getting better, and something went down the wrong way, and then I kept coughing.
Reactive.
Yes.
Let's discuss the validity and the reliability.
So I wonder if I could ask the steward of children's to tell us about this measure.
Actually, the developer.
That's
the developer.
Wonderful. The developer.
Oh, right. Okay. The burp. Okay, so I'm just going to give you a brief overview over the measure. We have high goals with this measure. We really hope that this survey becomes, so to speak, the pediatric HCAHPS. In the work I've done at Children's Hospital with also in collaboration with CHCA, I've seen the great heterogeneity in patient experience survey or patient satisfaction surveys, however you would like to call it. And I've also seen the quality of these surveys with regard to survey methodology principle. And I was quite appalled as a survey methodologist what I've seen. So we basically did this project to really get a set of survey items that could be used as, or like HCAHPS, as benchmarking across institutions, across the departments, within the institution for several dimensions of the care of patients. Due to the third party involved in pediatric settings, it's not really possible to just rephrase the HCAHPS questionnaire. There are certain aspects that have to be taken into account. And so we have several dimensions that this instrument that we propose addresses. There are experiences that parents report with regard to nurses, doctors, admission, discharge, care coordination, medications, and there are, of course, a set of demographic items in order to be able to look at differences between ethnicity, etc. For all items
reliability and validity data are available. So we have test, retest reliability. We have predictive validity. We have validity for items within a certain domain. We've calculated Cronbach alpha to make sure that there are no redundant items in there to minimize the respondent burden. We have validated, and I should say that these items are a subset of a 120-item questionnaire that we selected due to their good performance with regard to missing data, validity, ceiling effects, and reliability. The survey is validated for mail and phone, and the reason why, or we have also mode effects calculated. The reason why we were able to do that was because we had a very strict protocol when we started with this project. So patients that were recruited were randomly assigned to either mail or phone mode. So on average, we would really expect that the differences we observe are due to the mode and not to any other aspects of their care. We also have really rich frame information. We have kept data, process data in order to be able to look at non-response bias. We have medical record data so that we can stratify for different categories in complexity of care. So we can relate it to clinical outcomes. And what we are doing right now is that we are proposing within the framework of CHCA to field the survey at other institutions in order to use their data to get the survey down to about 30 questions. And we wanted to do this with other institutions to make sure that the questions that we select are really the ones that allow good validity and reliability across national institutions and not just one hospital. So we basically used our hospital to get to the 62 items that really perform good in terms of psychometric properties, and now want to go and use other hospitals as well to sort of get the survey shorter. We also plan to have the survey in other languages as well as an adolescent version. So the sampling approach that we proposed was a random sample of all patients that were discharged within a certain time period. It's obviously possible to stratify for race and ethnicity. We found, looking at the non-response across the different modes, that it's actually important to use a mixed mode approach for patient experience because Hispanics and other minorities were significantly more likely to answer the phone survey than the mail survey. So I think we have enough data to look outcomes across race, ethnicity. If this was the first hospital stay for the that child, if it was not the first hospital stay, if it was medical, surgical, how complex the procedure was. So based on the data in the survey as well as frame data, we can evaluate how the experiences of parents and patients differ across these dimensions.
Can you describe the domains, dimensions, and the measures that derive from the survey?
So we have not derived composite measures per se for the domains. Also, it's possible. So the domains are experiences with nurses, experiences with doctors, experiences with regard to how they work together, if the parent felt that there was communication. We ask about the admission process, about the discharge process, the care coordination after the discharge, medications within during the hospital stay, as well as medications that were provided when the child or prescribed when the child was going home. And then we have about 12 items that are demographic of me.
Again, so there are composites that are calculated. It's done as an item-by-item reporting.
It's an item-by-item, but it's completely possible to calculate composite scores. Because the scales are fairly similar, so most of the time, and there is, of course, I forgot to say, an overall rating. There is a section with a few overall ratings. So composite scores would be added, summative scores, and the scales are usually from 1 to 5.
Can you compare and contrast with the HCAPS? I mean, realizing that HCAPS, you would have to add either alternate questions, so it would be your child rather than you. But as you look at the structure of this compared to the HCAPS survey.
There are domains that are the same and where questions are very similar. There are also domains that we realized are more significant for the care. So, for example, parents with regard to how they rate their experiences at the hospital are really, really, or they feel it's very important with regard to the communication. So I don't think that the items that we have are more in number or higher in number than with regard to HCAPS, just by the fact how predictive they were with regard to how the parent rates their experience in the hospital.
I'm sorry. So there are more items because there were a more diverse number of issues?
There are more, right. There are more aspects, I think, in a pediatric setting that that are important to consider with regard to the overall satisfaction. They were highly predictive of overall satisfaction, but the correlation among them was fairly low, so that, you know, we can assume that they measure different dimensions.
Could you just tell us a little bit more about the domain you talked about, care coordination after discharge, that care coordination between home?
So we have items in there that ask if they have seen their primary care physician right after they went home. We also, I mean, that's, I think, one of the... We also asked about if they felt comfortable to go home with regard to the information they had, things like that.
Okay. In some of the work that we've done, focus groups with families across the country, the care coordination element turns out to be very, very important to them. That's one of the areas in which they feel
that's correct.
It doesn't work very well.
And the other thing...
Going a little bit beyond the hospital here.
Well, the other thing that that one of the comment mentioned sort of as a point was that we do not collect the data sort of during the hospital stay. And the reason why we do not collect the data during the hospital stay is that we also want their experiences with regard to discharge and sort of right after discharge. And that's the reason why we can't... I mean, either we then have two surveys, but then it's really hard to link them together and to get responses from the parent in both. So that's why we are doing it after the child has left the hospital.
So are there questions from the work group? We've started already, but are there questions from the work group that reviewed this?
I have one question. Do we have a copy of the survey form?
Yes. Yeah.
Where was it?
Yeah, we submitted the current survey tool when we submitted the measure.
Can I have one more question?
Yes.
You're talking about developing an adolescent tool.
Yes.
And this is an issue that came up frequently for those of us who are on the older group way back when HCAPS was being developed, because we were concerned particularly about the teenager who was hospitalized, most often for maternity care, but also for other reasons, you know, like they keep down health into a tree. And we really wanted the adolescent patient assessment of care rather than the parent's assessment of care. And you don't have that subset yet, so you're putting the adolescents in here.
No, so this survey will be for parents 18 years and older of their child. The reason why we did this is because we really wanted to develop an extra tool just for adolescents.
Right, but for the interim, if my teenage child is discharged, you're going to ask me my opinion of the experience and not that.
Sorry, I misunderstood you. Now, yes. I mean, we definitely could, go down to maybe 15, 16 years. I wouldn't go down to, like, I mean, not that I know how often this happens, but, like, 13 years, because from a scientific point of view, we don't know enough about the response formation process in adolescents, and there is a lot of research to be done.
So just for the members of the committee who maybe hadn't seen the survey, it was misfiled. It's under Workgroup 1, Measure 27.
It's a PDF document.
So if you happen to have your flash drive, that's where the item is. I guess the more the scientific characteristics, right up says you describe things like Cronbach alpha, dimension, things like that, but I don't actually, I'm still asking the question of dimensions, because typically that's what the CAP survey, that's typically what people report out. It used to be in the old days when I used to.
The dimensions are basically the headings in the survey, and so we have a report about 300 pages long that describes all of the results. I was a little unclear how to sort of attach that to the, but to describe that that in the application. So I'm definitely happy to submit that one. So we've done factor analysis, et cetera, of the items that we had where we selected these 62 from. And it's nursing, doctors, medications, admission, discharge.
Just from the perspective of this tool, the possibility of reporting out by composite score will be able to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
So, Ellen?
I'm sorry, I'm going to share the microphone with you. Sitting right next to you. I guess two questions. One, you mentioned the importance of having both modes. Have you found a difference in response, in mode influencing the response, whether it's phone or mail?
So there are some differences with regard to distribution. So at Children's Hospital Boston, we have the problem that I think no national survey ever has, that like everyone's always super satisfied. So you have like this ceiling effect, and it's really hard to track something over time if everyone's always satisfied. So we try to extend the scale in a way based on focus groups and during the survey what people actually reported in order to get sort of the differences. In the telephone survey, which is known from a scientific point of view, people are more likely on average to rate it higher. However, the items that had significant differences on, I think there is only one item left in the set of 62. So the reason why we started out with 120 were really to figure out what are the items that have high percentages of missing data that have a great ceiling effect where tracking change is hard, that have low test retest reliability, and that's exactly why we excluded them. So another factor was if the mode effect was very strong, We also considered the item to be excluded in order to minimize that exact problem.
And then the only the other question I had is it sounded like, I think you mentioned earlier, that you're hoping to reduce the number of items in the survey.
Yes.
And so kind of what's the plan going forward for the timeline for doing that?
So we are right now we are talking with CHCA about how to set all of this up, and we had talked with CHCA about a year ago, and there are a number of hospitals that are interested in fielding this survey to compare it to the current survey that they have. So there is interest there. I think the steps forward that have to be figured out is, from a methodological point of view, what I would really like is I would also get data that's at the same time collected using the current tool from the hospital as well as the scores. It would have to be randomly selected what patient gets what tool or what parent gets what tool, so that we really can assess if there are differences across hospital with regard to the validity of items, how these items fall within a dimension, if there are, so just really, we didn't do that for the current version because of the importance to really look at several institutions and see if we want to use this nationally, then we really should use items that are applicable to all institutions and not just to the Children's Hospital Boston. So that's why we felt, okay, we start out with 120. We get the items out that perform badly from a psychometric point of view and from a survey methods point of view. Then we basically go national and say, okay, let's collect data. Let's collect data to compare it at the same time so that we can really make sure that the ultimate tool with about 30 items, that the measures that are in there are really the ones that are applicable and good for every institution, if I can say it like that.
Sure. So that was sort of my question about your factor analysis. You think you've done more limited factor analysis, you're going to do more later?
Correct.
Okay.
So it's really, yeah, I want to get the data and figure out, you know, is there an item that's yeah. really important, that's, or based on the current analysis, seems to be really important for our situation, but that might not be that important if I take other data into account.
You mentioned HCAHPS before. Who is the owner of HCAHPS, and have you talked with them about an HCAHPS version that would be for children and one for adolescents, so that non-children's hospital would not be would be dealing with one organization or one set of questionnaires?
The measurement owner or developer is ARC. We have not been in contact with them yet. The last thing that I've heard based on their statement on their website is that they are not currently working at a pediatric version. I'm not quite sure if behind the curtain, so to speak, there is something going on. This survey will nevertheless be able to be used in hospitals that just have sort of a pediatric department and are not freestanding. So the way we phrased the question was that we really wanted to make sure that it would be applicable for all situations.
Maybe the not created here wouldn't apply, and ARC might be welcome working with you.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Probably have a less interesting question than Marina. But I was wondering, in sort of your preliminary analyses, whether you explored the impact of variable length of stay.
Yes. So length of stay, we explored length of stay, medical, surgical, if this is the first time they're at the hospital or not. So generally, you know, I mean, it depends on the item, but overall I can say that people who are not the first, where this is not the first hospital stay, are overall less satisfied. That people who have a high, like a longer length of stay are less satisfied. Minorities overall seem to be less satisfied, and medical are less satisfied as well.
And how did you think about the impact of the severity of the illness and the child's prognosis?
This is a really good question. So the problem with surveys in general is that they're measuring something that usually cannot be measured otherwise. So from a provider perspective, we would hope that, I mean, they should be satisfied no matter how they go through the hospital. No matter how long they stay, no matter how often they have to come back, that the service that we provide should be satisfactory. The other thing is it's always based on expectations. So parents that, for example, have been in hospital previously have other expectations than parents that have there been the first time. So there will always be a subjective, based on just the experience that you had, there will always be sort of an influence of expectations. And that's what surveys basically measure. It's really hard to sort of get people to set to an expectation. They come in with an expectation, and these expectations vary. But I think from a hospital point of view, no matter what these expectations are, our goal is that parents have a good experience.
And I just had one more question, and that was with a response rate of 25-35%. I know this is kind of a generic question.
That's actually a comment.
Oh.
So. Go ahead. Sorry.
How are you thinking about the selection bias, i.e., how do you avoid overrepresenting happy campers?
So this is a common phenomenon in satisfaction surveys, and the concerns are that happy campers and really really unhappy campers do not answer. So what we found is that on average in this survey, it equals out. So it doesn't really affect the score. We can say that because we have frame data. So if you have frame data, you can actually adjust for it. So you can, use non-response weighting, that's another part of this project, to calculate non-response weight to see how that affects actually the differences of the scores. You need a really good protocol to make them participate. The unfortunate thing is that the survey climate nowadays is, everyone's completely over-surveyed, and you really have to write a letter that convinces the participant or the parent to participate.
One more issue, and that is you only have your English speakers, as you had said. And so I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more, particularly that something like this could not be used in California.
And that's where basically the plan is. So we started out with the English version. We plan to develop this into other languages. I mean, that's one goal, to be able to use it as an, you know, as a sort of, if I can frame it like that, pediatric age caps tool.
Okay. We may not have caught some of the questions that are intended to get to this, but going back to Lee's point about care coordination, and particularly the handoff from the inpatient to the outpatient setting, this is a really sensitive area, and an area that gets a lot of attention from the consumer community.
But I don't see, as Rita and I have been scrolling through your questions here, the questions appear to be more oriented toward parent satisfaction, that
right.
They understood something about medication and so on, but not specifically toward the issue of did they get adequate instruction about what to do with the child once they left the hospital? How do they hand off from the main, as you call them, the main physician in the hospital to the office-based practice. Is there a different instrument that does that, or do you just presume that every child who leaves your institution has a care plan, so that's not even a question that should be asked?
No. So if you're sort of really interested in that domain, I refer you to Jay Berry, who's actually working on that right now. So I have the honor to work with him on that as well with regard to the survey. So this is really an experience survey. So while I completely agree with you that that might not be the case for every child, what we are really trying to measure is the satisfaction. And if parents see that the care does, that there is something that they're missing or it's difficult and the left hand doesn't know what the right is doing, they will express that in the satisfaction. So it's really to measure the subjective view of the process. So patients can be really, really satisfied, or parents can be really satisfied, even though the medical care itself might not have been optimal. But it's hard for a parent to judge that because the parent doesn't know the standards. And so this is really to get at the subjective opinions of the parents.
Okay, I would just say that particularly with parents who have children with chronic conditions and who are in and out of the hospital on a regular basis, they a part of satisfaction is going to be feeling confident that they know what to do once they leave the institution, who to call,
so
where to go.
That's a very important piece of this, and this is more general. And as Dr. Sunil said, Dr. Berry is working on one for complex care. I just wanted to add another bit of a detail about how we got into this process, which was that we always intended to do this, but about 2 years ago, one of our payers came to the table and said, you will do HCAHPS for a P4P contract, a huge piece of it. And we said to them, there is no pediatric HCAHPS. And so that has been the impetus to this, of trying to develop something that could be used across the country and would carefully reflect domains specific, not just changing from you to your child, a lot of rigor into that measurement process, and that's what we've been doing.
Tom, did you first have a question, and then Ellen and
Jay? You know, our hospital has been doing the Press Ganey surveys for years, and obviously it crosses over to the children that get care in our hospital, and I suspect other hospitals do that. I don't know whether you've taken a look at your survey versus the Press Ganey survey, and I suspect there may be some overlaps, and there may be a way of sort of trying to help form which of your questions are the ones that are most important based on Press Ganey as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's one reason why we planned the multi-center. So we are not using Press Ganey. It's really hard to get data from hospitals. In terms, you know, to basically say, you know, we would love to have your data to be able to analyze it with regard to patient satisfaction. And that's one of sort of the condition I would like to put on this sort of more national project, to say I really would like to see the data that you currently collect during the same time span with your instrument, to be able to see how they actually correlate.
Ellen and then Jay.
I just wanted to make the point. First, I really want to applaud you for this work, because I think it is a huge gap that we don't have a pediatric HCAP. I think the survey, Marina, to your question, in my view, it goes beyond satisfaction. It includes parent reports on how well prepared they were. So it may be perceptions of care, but in my view, it's more than satisfaction. What I'm struggling with a bit is it sounds like it's still being developed. And I guess I need to understand a little bit from the NQF staff perspective. you know, what the implications of endorsing this are, given that, you know, you're looking to maybe reduce the number of items, you know, and then kind of knowing a little bit about the history of HCAPs and the vendor involvement in that, I'm struggling a bit with, well, you know, nobody's stepped up to do that, although there are instruments out there. I guess I'm struggling with kind of what the path forward in terms of process needs to be, but I also feel like, you know, this is the first opportunity we've had to really look at a great step in the direction of developing a survey.
Do you want to respond to that, and then we have Faye in
the Sure, I'll just respond briefly. I mean, certainly, you know, the group would have to decide if they feel like it's ready for prime time. That's sort of the issue. We do routinely get measures that get updated. We have a 3-year maintenance policy so that, you know, if you made a significant change to the survey, you'd have to bring it back to us for our review, so that's fine. I don't see that as a problem. My major question was actually more about harmonization, and I know you can't harmonize completely with the CAPS tool, but and I gave my bias here as an adult-only doc, but a whole lot of these items look really similar to HCAPS. So I'm imagining myself in my old days as direct quality measure for a hospital. If I had to look at the HCAPS responses on some of these and then look at these, the response categories aren't aligned. You have 5, they've gone to 3. I'm just trying to think about what a hospital who's not a freestanding children's hospital would have to sort of think through to make it work. If you had adult surgery, we used to shred up our day by adult surgery and OB. We didn't have kids at the Brigham, but how would you imagine this kind of working in the real world, I guess?
Yeah, so the problem with the response categories, where from a scientific point of view, sort of what you would really like to measure is with a 3-category scale based on the feelings effect that we just observe in our hospital, there is no way you would be able to really measure a change. If 85% are in the top category, how would you measure change? So, I mean, this tool is basically really to, you know, be able to measure change. So, I mean, you know, not that I was in the art group and want to criticize their work, but when I looked at HCAPS, I didn't understand why they have 3. I mean, 3 is really limited. Like, you know, so the problem that we have seen in the focus groups is it's really hard to get someone who, you know, almost always satisfied to completely satisfied. Yeah.
I think some of this actually truly is the nature of adult care versus kids care. I mean, I've seen HCAP scores, and it's remarkable how much display there is between those categories. Mm-hmm. And it may just be that, you know, maybe kids truly, Lisa Simpson always told me, they're not just little adults. Maybe they're really different. And, you know, maybe the parents have very different perspectives on their care.
I mean, that's why
everything's great.
Right. I mean, that's why we, for example, selected the 5-point scale, because with a 3-point scale, we wouldn't be, I mean, there would be no chance.
That's very helpful. And maybe just those, right. Right, and maybe just some of those responses back formally before we just put them out.
I mean, the other thing is like what I just don't know is on a national level, when we give this instrument to other hospitals, what the range, you know, is there. And you know, with regard to what you report, I mean, boards usually like to see the percentage where everyone is super satisfied. From a improvement point of view, I want to see the percentage that has really problems. Because that's where you actually can do something about it.
I'm with you. What I'll tell you, though, is HCAPS actually shows that. Only because you'd be amazed at how poor this is when patients report on their care. It's not satisfaction. It's only one satisfaction item on CAPS. It's really the very similar patient reports of care. Did somebody explain your medications to you in a way you can understand? Did somebody explain your discharge instructions? That always sometimes, those categories are remarkably show lots of dissatisfaction.
The percent always, that's
really
low.
So,
and it is hard to get.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, based on the data that we have, I can tell you, I mean, we have items that have like 85% always, very satisfied, extremely. And from, I mean, that's where, you know, we started developing the survey. So how do you measure something if you have 85%, you know,
I think you just justified it, but I think those are probably some of the explanations we would need when this would go out forward.
Okay.
Otherwise, you would look at this, particularly people who know CAPS well, and
We also wanted to just share that we did do an assessment of the freestanding hospitals, and one-third use Picker, one-third use Prescani, and actually one-third have a hybrid, which makes it very interesting.
Yeah.
Or some other agent, other vendor.
I think, Betty, you were up next.
I just have several quick questions. Number one, how do you explain to the parent who the physician is or who the nurse is and how they're going to use that as a base to make the decision about their medicine, especially in a teaching hospital?
So we actually had items, well, we...
So originally what we did when we planned this out was have whole focus groups, and when we asked the question about satisfaction with your physician, the very first thing they asked was, which one? Because we're in an academic medical center. So the team put together a whole battery of tests, of test questions specific to residents,
if you're a resident or if it's the attending.
And now you can tell the results.
So the results were interesting because if it's the first hospital stay, about 80% or I think it was 80 or 85 people could not tell the difference. So it was like, I don't know what the difference is. So they said, you know, like I didn't have a resident or a fellow. I mean, this is a teaching hospital. Like there is no child that goes through there that doesn't see someone who is in teaching. So we knew that they can't, it's all doctors, right? All white coats. So however, in the people that are, you know, frequent flyers and are there more often, they can make the difference. So now if I can sort of take a step back, that's why we didn't include it here, but we at Children's would like to go to a modular system to have this as a core and add on module questions that like rotate throughout the year that will allow us to get to certain areas and have, for example, 10 questions. So there will be surgery, ER, ICU, and one of these modules will be the question with regard to the difference of attendings and fellows. But we would only, so the kind of the criteria would be that it would not be a person who was staying there the first time, because it's just they can't be, it can't, it's really the people that have been there before know the difference, the other people don't.
Well, yes, I think that to determine the difference sometimes can be quite a struggle for seasoned people in hospital settings. The same question could be also related to nurses. What nurses are you talking about? Because there are three shifts or two shifts.
Yes.
And many people who provide many different services. And how do you differentiate them from the people who come up to do the x-rays, to take the blood, the respiratory therapist, because all of them are in a care mode.
Yeah, we had
a lot to ask people to separate and to understand conceptually what they're doing.
That's correct. And we had items like that in there too, and they have really high missing value rates. Because people just cannot, it's one of these things that I think surveys have to deal with, because you can only ask questions where people know something about. If they don't know the difference, there is no point in asking a question, and people really have difficulties, and I think it's just sort of how compressed everything is to, you know, they go from one department to the other, it's like they can't remember who was what and who had what title and what procedure they got.
We're not saying that that's not important. It was an aha moment for us.
It was an aha, because we had this in there, and, you know, we asked them, you know, how did these technicians do and that, those technicians. And, I mean, people sometimes, you know, had they had procedures, and the parent would indicate they didn't.
The other follow-up question to that is, this is about satisfaction. And the way I'm looking at it, it's about the child, the children. Because they are over 13, so they're big children.
No, it's all children. It's
you said you're not asking anyone who's younger than.
No.
So this survey, so the question that came up here was if we should give the surveys to parents that are teenage parents.
Okay.
So this survey is for parents of all ages of children that are at the hospital. We would like to develop a version for adolescents, for example, for the patient itself. But I think that this instrument is completely feasible for example, 15 years, a parent of 15 years and older.
Okay, that clarifies one part of the question. But the other part of the question is that it seems to me, in many ways, for the older children, at least it's a proxy measure. And have you thought through what happens when the parent wants to participate and the child does not want? Or is that a problem that you ask in the parent about the child and the child would prefer not to have parents respond on his or her behalf about the care?
So I don't think that we have, clearly thought through, and I think this is a great opportunity for a scientific study with regard to proxy measures. So I have looked at other data there are areas where the parent is much better as a reporter than the child. There are also areas where the child is a better reporter than the parent. So if I construct this sort of adolescent survey, I'm pretty sure that one of the items for the adolescents would be, was I able to sleep in? Has a clear impact on satisfaction for an adolescent in the hospital, which, right, we would consider as fairly unimportant in the grand scheme of things. So I've never encountered that an adolescent was not happy because the parent rated on their part. I mean, the survey was never introduced that way. It was really, what were your experiences in the hospital?
What was the parent's experience?
Correct.
Not the child's experience.
Correct.
So we could talk at great length about the survey.
Question number.
Go ahead.
Just a very quick question. Are you planning to make available to the public the results of the surveys on a regular basis? And how do you do that? Do you do that in each of the question categories, or is it just selected questions, or how do you handle that?
I mean, theoretically, it's possible to display every question.
But what have you done with CAPS, for example?
Have
you discussed how you intend to make the information available to them?
So I definitely think that it would be on the web page. The other thing that...
I think it's a little bit, just a little bit of a different question. You're talking about, would this be, if I'm understanding you correctly, the question is, how would this be available to everybody?
Right. If I'm a parent considering your institution and I went on your website, would I be able to find the answers to these questions?
Or could you go to any website and find out comparative data on institute Boston
commercial? There's a couple of, our goal is definitely to try to make this the pediatric age caps. At that point, it would be available in public domain to whomever. At that time, and your question about contacting ARC would also be about contacting the individual vendors who are going to basically be able to pick this up and move ahead with it.
Right.
But from a perspective of, maybe you could just share the experience that we've done with the Children's Hospital-based measures, which is our first step of taking a high-level measure and agreeing that we're going to look at it together.
You mean with regard to the differences and...
Well, just the process of trying to get people to accept the measure.
So CHCA has this initiative about whole system measures. I don't know if you know about it or not. So there was a group formed about service excellence, and we had, I think, 15 representatives of hospital in there. And we were trying to figure out what question to use to be able to compare across these 15 hospitals. And it was a rather difficult discussion because people do not want to change their measure because they always measured it that way. And, how could you compare it if you changed it? And just administering the two surveys for a while at the same time to be able to recalculate one score or the other didn't seem as a valid option for them either. the questions are sometimes very different. There are sometimes, if I might say from a scientific point of view, plain and simple horrible. I mean, how likely or unlikely would you be to recommend this hospital to families and friends? And the answer categories are poor. Yeah, I mean, hello. Anyhow, so it was a real battle to get 15 hospitals to agree to choose the question, how satisfied or unsatisfied are you with the quality of care at this hospital? We discussed this for over a year.
But it's being trained.
It's being trained.
It's being rolled out and it's finally accepted. So that we anticipate is going to be part of moving this forward.
But we really hope, I mean, based on this experience, what we really hope is that there will be a national measure that everyone will use and that really allows to compare across hospitals and, you know, states. I mean, right now it's really hard because the questions are different, the modes are different, there are no adjustments, you know, recommended whatsoever.
So I'm going to take the chair's prerogative here and first tell a brief story and then move this along. The brief story is I was involved, as you may not want to get familiar, in developing a previous iteration of the Boston Children's Taker Hospital Survey. My very first presentation at Children's Hospital in 1991 as a presenter was, do you know who your child's doctor is? And the answer was, of course, no. With what you were reporting. It's interesting how some things change and some things don't. Because it's hard in a complex institution. So having said that, we do need to sort of wrap this conversation up and come to a decision about where we're going to go with this survey. We have the process we need to go through. So the first would be we need a series of votes on these. So the first one is this concept or construct or measure sufficiently important for us to proceed? And I'd like to call the vote. All those who believe this is sufficiently important, show your hand.
How's Tom going?
Yeah, I was going to say, Tom, how are you doing there?
So everyone, were there any? They were all yes?
Yes, except Tom.
Oh, well, sorry. Yes,
okay,
thank more.
You. All right.
All right.
Thanks, Tom.
So the next question is the scientific acceptability of the measure. And to be honest, I would contend that we haven't, because the developers didn't know how to present it. Send us the information we're concerned we'd be overwhelmed by a 300-page document. I'm a little concerned we don't have sufficient information to actually make that judgment. So I guess I need to call for a vote as to whether it's... So I guess really where I'm going on this is rather than proceed with the next series of votes on this, do we want to, again, request the developer to provide us some of that additional information.
Can I just have a question? You know, in methods measurements, you know, when you scale, we tend to accept indices that are slightly less than an older, well-established scale. Could that also be true for our assessment here, that we recognize that it's a very new scale, and it's under development, and that the author or the developer is willing to continue to provide us with reliability, validity, and development?
Well, with the caveat, as Helen pointed out earlier, if we endorse or recommend endorsement, that would be easy. Basically, anybody else can pick this item up and use it, and that we would have some assumption of comparability across institutions.
For Charlie, it might just be that we would ask you to actually submit that document and perhaps just give a brief summary of the reliability and validity based on the statistics that are in there. And you could vote on it today conditional upon approval of that plan, just so you don't have to get into yet another spinning game.
Okay. So that makes... So should we proceed then with the different votes on the different elements and then come back? Okay, so in terms of scientific acceptability, that how many would feel this is meets the criteria for scientific acceptability? How many see none? How many feel this partially meets the criteria for scientific acceptability? All right, so then I'll move to minimally meets the criteria.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so everybody. Thanks. That's what I'm looking for.
So then the next one is usability, which is how interpretable are the results, as well as, what can I remember the other one? No, how understandable they are, whether they're harmonized, and again, we've got this issue of comparability with caps and where it is and isn't, and the added value. Again, and there is no age caps for pediatrics, so, but there are different scales and things like that. So how many would vote that it completely meets the criteria for usability? How many would say it partially meets the criteria for usability?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9.
How many believe it minimally meets the criteria for usability?
2, 3.
Not at all.
I was just going to say,
I don't have any comparative data in English. And English. Good. And then for feasibility, again, data clearly are not a byproduct of care. This needs to be surveyed. But it is feasible. Electronic exclusions, potential for inaccuracies, and experience with or capability for widespread implementation. Yes.
One question, please, may I?
Related to feasibility, sure.
I think it was Maria asked about how this data might be used by consumers. But I wanted to also know, have you all thought through in your focus groups or whatever how this data will be used at the hospital for among the providers to improve care? That's number one. And number two, do we understand the definition that you share with people who participate about what quality of care means? Because even providers don't have any clear idea about what quality is. And how do you grapple with that? Do you give a scenario, how are you going to do that?
So, from a standardized interview point, my answer to your last question would be whatever it means to you. It's really hard to give definitions for a concept because once you give a definition, I mean, how complicated would that definition be? Would people understand it? And with regard to scenarios, there is enough scientific evidence that scenarios actually bias the way you answer, because people will only think about these scenarios you provide. So that's why, I mean, it's really what the parent encompasses in that quality of care for themselves. As subjective as satisfaction. Your first question? Or, go ahead.
I'm just concerned that people in general, the health literacy issues, prohibit many, many people from understanding what quality of care is. So I'm wondering if it's quality of care you're measuring of one's own experience in terms of interactions with staff.
I do think that question has been subject to very extensive. And there have been a lot of focus groups, there have been a lot of cognitive interviews across a variety of socioeconomics. Even though the term is very abstract, people are able to make judgments and with either this poor to exceptional or 1 to 10 scale around rating quality of care.
My rebuttal, quote-unquote, would be if the providers can't decide what quality of care, like how should we explain it to a parent?
That's the first line, actually, of Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Yeah. Quality. So,
I mean, definitely there is a long-term monitoring of, how rates change. The other thing that I would personally like to see with this instrument is that there is a clear you know, linkage to data with regard to departments, so that if the percentage of people that say they really had a problem, you know, sort of below the standard, like poor to excellent, where people say, you know, poor to average, that the department sort of really has to address if that percentage, for example, goes up. And I think that that tool is really to monitor how it goes overall, and if that this percentage increases or the percent of, you know, satisfied, very satisfied drops, that that's really the point where, you know, the department or whatever area it is that, that shows these changes has to start investigating what's going on.
So I'm going to go, thank you for the question and the response. I'm going to go back to voting on the feasibility question. How many believe that this completely meets the criteria for feasibility? Again, the components of feasibility are, they don't... Again, it's a little challenging because the data is not being, because it's a survey, but basically how feasible is this to implement, what's the burden, the hassle, how well specified is it, how easily could somebody, could this be picked up and done in a consistent manner. So how many believe this completely meets criteria for feasibility? We said that how many partially meets the criteria for feasibility?
Okay.
Minimally meets the criteria for feasibility.
10.
And that's one in the not at all?
Yeah, no.
All right, and now I think it is, again, comes the question of whether we move to endorse it or not. So I think there are several options that we have on the table. One is, as we did, I think it's one of the early ones, to not move that question, but rather recommend that a request that we have additional data provided to the committee. We were basically, I mean, we
could
just
move it with conditions.
Right.
So we could do one.
Conditions on satisfactory analysis of the tone.
Okay, so we could do one of three things, but I really wanted two things in my view. One is not vote. And request further information. Second is vote conditional, and I would still say vote for time limited because, again, this is only in English, this hasn't been applied across the one institution. We haven't been presented with domain scores or mechanisms for, you know, mechanisms really for reporting out. So we could either make a conditional. We could either request more information or we could vote a conditional endorsement. I think those are really good for just the option. Please.
I think probably several of us are struggling with the problem that the work has been largely done in cooperation with Children's Hospital. And I think I heard Alan say that Pfizer might just... Well, but you also had conversations with other children's hospitals.
So that's, yeah, only one question really at a section.
Right. I think... my basic dilemma is I want an ACS for pediatrics. What I don't feel comfortable with is, as we have it in front of us today, how well it would also work in Kaiser's hospitals or in community hospitals in more rural areas. And so, and I don't know whether we can get that in a reasonable period of time. I think it's difficult to get it through the NQF process without having a little better sense of how it would work outside Children's Hospital.
I didn't speak directly to Kaiser, but knowing how it works, I think that they would respond better to a pediatric questionnaire that was under the HCAPS title, which they already use, than a totally new questionnaire, and also the issue of similar roll-ups so they could have some comparison of their pediatric services to their adult services, recognizing the differences. And I'm usually not one
who advocates that children are small adults.
I did just email the CAP team. It helps when I spend 7 years there. I can do that stuff. So they wrote me back. The CAP team acknowledges the importance of this population, but they have limited resources to do it at this time. So I think the reality is that's not there now. So there you go.
And we all are very aware of that. And therefore, you don't want to stifle innovation.
Progress.
Right.
Our most important.
And at some point, if that children, if a pediatric HCAP came in, those measures could be harmonized or could be, one would be determined to be best in class. But at this point, there's not a competing measure on the table. The theoretical one, I'm saying, but it doesn't exist.
But I also know what was required of the CAPS team to get through both NCQA approval and then all NQF approval, which was vastly more.
That was the first time.
Data.
It hasn't been that way since. And the first time, I was at ARC at the time. I mean,
yes.
HCAPS was just a more of a political battle than anything else. But actually, getting it through NQF actually wasn't the problem.
But I did sit, I sat, as you know, on the hospital
right.
review committee, and it wasn't, there was a lot more data presented. So I'm just
okay.
a little worried that, but, you know, that we haven't yet seen comparative data. We don't have the main source, but that's my own stick. I mean, I'm just being.
Why don't you just
what
about that?
I'd just like to say, if anyone here has any suggestions or advice for us, we would be more than entertain them, because we started by having the adult measure tried to be, you know, stuffed down on us, which
right.
is how we got this far. You guys are seeing exactly how far we've gone.
Recognizing that HCAPS doesn't have the resources to start from scratch and write a pediatric questionnaire, they might welcome working with you merge the two. And it would require much reduced resources on their part and acknowledge the extensive work that you have done. So I think that might be a compromise that would be more satisfactory to many people.
But I don't want to put on the team, they're not in control of whether the eighth class people will work with them or not. So that seems, it is a wonderful suggestion, but, you know.
But to your point, I think based on what you just said, this discomfort is just, I think we should actually wait and get the methods piece back to a specialized lane validity and just put around on a conference call. I think doing it now would feel premature, it sounds like, for too many folks.
Well, it would be three. I'm speaking more as an individual than as the chair. So, so my motion would be that we request additional information specifically on the domain score issue and really, I think, even CRISPR specifications that tied to how what the measures, what the reporting would look like. And I think, and then bring that back for a vote for a time-limited endorsement based on that. And then I think the condition probably at the time of the time-limited endorsement would be application across multiple institutions to look at the feasibility of use. And that would be the criteria for coming back within 12 months, more or less, after we do the time-limited endorsement. So that's my motion, is that we defer a vote pending additional information. Do I have general agreement? I've seen a lot of head shaking that we do that.
Maybe disagree.
Okay. All right. So why don't we go forward with that?
And I'm also happy to play the matchmaking role if you'd like with ARC.
I guess I would be specifically interested in ARC, in where there are disparities in scales in particular. Like, again, we've got this different 5-point scale than the standard CAPS 10-point overall rating scale, which I know was a very intensely researched topic. You know, I'd at least like to hear a little bit more than having my old survey researchers coming out on some of those items. But,
yeah, I'm happy to do that.
Thank you very much. It was a wonderful discussion. Wonderful
Thank
work.
You.
And also, I guess on behalf of the child health community, express my appreciation to Boston Children's for investing in developing and moving this measure. So
Thank you.
It's great.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Okay. We have 5 measures left in about 50 minutes.
So 10 minutes is good now.
I think we all know that that's probably not going to happen. This is my suggestion. The five measures left are the individual metrics that are, again, part of this larger survey measure submitted by CAMI. My suggestion is either out of the five, if we could quickly look through them just based on maybe title, description, and the reviewers who looked at it and do a scope call. Because I know a lot of the other individual metrics, we view them as out of scope for, you know, various reasons. And also, taking up the first measure to look through more in depth, if it does get that far, is the one on the measure of a medical home for children and adolescents, only because I think that one will probably have a little more discussion than the others. Is that okay with the group to do that first and go from there?
Any objections to that?
So, okay, so the first out of the five is 41, and again, just this is a brief,
group,
you know.
Four. Group, group four? Fourth group?
Or? Yes, this is work group four. Sorry. Apologize. I'm just trying to get to these. I'm probably talking, working faster than I should. So this is group four. Unfortunately, Tom had to leave early, but he did provide his feedback, so you probably, that's probably what you see up on the screen is mainly his comments and ratings. But first measure 41 is children who attend schools perceived as safe, and this measure ascertains the perceived safety of the child's school. So again, just looking at that description and based on the reviewers who did look at the measure more in depth, if we could kind of give a call as far as importance and scope, whether it fits within scope of the project.
I was on work group four, and I was a negative on this one. Primarily because I had difficulty with evidence of relationship to child health. And we had a long discussion about this issue in the context of a measure two above, which is children who live in communities perceived as safe. So I guess from my point of view right now, I would still consider this one out of scope, but I'm willing to be convinced. I was on the subgroup that reviewed this, and I would concur with that. This is a single item on a larger questionnaire. It's a single item. It's very general. The only thing I could think of that would be of interest in this would be bullying, and I don't think that the statement on linked to outcomes was strong enough, as is written here. I'm not sure that it's not, actually, because it is a child's school. But I would be fine if it's out of scope. It's a single item and it's very general. And it isn't.
Ellen?
I was not part of that work group, so I hope I'm not out of turn speaking. I agree with what's been said, but then it seems inconsistent to me that we would endorse the safe community and not endorse the safe school.
Well, the amenities. The amenities was out.
The amenities was out.
The amenities
was
out. The community was in. Yeah. Yeah, that's what it was. So.
I had some school
which is one thing I was thinking about. I did want to ask us to review maybe a little bit of the discussion about the safety in neighborhoods, right? That was a safety community. In neighborhoods.
Community.
We felt that the experience of being safe in your community was an important health-related stressor. And so the question is whether we feel that the perception of safety in this
school is physical functioning and obesity. In this document, the summary of evidence for linkage was that children who attend schools that are usually or always felt as safe are much more likely to be in better overall health than those who attend schools which are never safe, 85% to 59%. That is the only piece of evidence that we have in this document that they listed.
So Charlie, when you made the comment that for the communities, it seemed to correlate with their sense of safety correlated with their health. Why, since the child spends so much time in school, wouldn't it sort of be the same logic?
You could make that argument.
And I,
Why isn't the school part of your community?
Yeah, it is. It's what.
I mean.
Maybe we should say.
This is Scott Stembo. I'm on the call.
One of the struggles I had is that some schools are in very blighted neighborhoods, and children feel very unsafe when they're walking from home to the school. And when they get to the school, they may feel relatively safe in the school, but when they walk out on the sidewalk and head home, they don't feel safe. Lots of things happen between school and home.
It may be the opposite too, though, right?
Yeah, it might be the opposite.
Community safety.
Then in some of the schools, there are police in the schools, and there are surveillance equipment in the school to make the children feel safe. And those neighborhoods, I would suggest, are relatively unsafe. So in my mind, I it's hard for me to separate out a safe school and not a safe neighborhood. There's no information about how a child feels safe in the neighborhood. And then conflicts in the school just spill over in the neighborhood.
Have you looked at the correlation between these two items?
They're highly correlated.
Okay. Is there additional information in one compared to the other, or are they so highly correlated that they're really no added value?
That I don't know. I'm not sure.
So I guess for consistency's, I mean, I'm not going to revisit yesterday's vote. For consistency's sake, it's hard, I guess, in light of this conversation, for us to do this RAS scope. Is that inaccurate?
So it is
within scope. So that means, how do you want to deal with that? So that means, do you want to go to the other ones that we think maybe are out of scope? And then we'll either come back to that one or we'll come back to it in a couple.
Okay, the next one on the list is 42. It's children who receive the mental health care they need. And this is the percentage of children aged 2 to 17 who have an ongoing condition which require mental health care who actually have seen a mental health care professional in the past 12 months.
So I guess the question would be, is this a process measure or an outcome measure?
I was in two minds about this. I think it's at face value, it's a process measure, but as a general pediatrician, I know that that is such a critical early make or break, and that's really the thing that we're dealing with that I was trying to figure out is if it moves over to being somewhat of a proxy measure. But,
I think, I
had some concerns. And my initial impression was that there was too much diversity in what a mental health professional was, and that I could not link sort of whether the condition that child had connected with the right provider.
Could we confine to the responses to this issue of whether it's whether we consider it a process or if that's really going to be a question of whether we consider this in scope or out of scope as opposed to the validity of the measure?
Seeing a mental health professional may lead to better outcome or may not, so I see it as a process measure. It's just one step on the path. It may lead to better outcome.
No, I came up, I felt it was partially important. I'm perfectly happy ruling it out as a process measure.
But I don't want to rule it out totally, do you?
So that means just goes to our meeting in July.
I just want to make sure I'm clear on that. Okay, all right.
Oh.
At least they used it, Abraham.
All right, I'll have to take any more Prozac then.
So I think this one.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So this is, it's not purely based on an item saying, you know, did you or did you not see a mental health professional? There is an identified need. So this, I would think, would fall under the same category as any other unmet need for access in healthcare. And so in my mind, that puts it much more in the realm of an outcome. If it was just, you know, did you or did you not see a mental health professional, but there's clearly based on a, it's a two-item measure, and based on the first item, the child has been identified as having an ongoing need of not just a crisis mental health issue, but an ongoing need for mental health care. And then completely unrelated in a different part of the survey, it says, by the way, did you happen to see a mental health professional last 12 months? And it does define what could be included in a mental health professional. And so those who said no, but somehow indicated earlier on that their child did indeed have a need, that is who is in this numerator.
Use your microphones, please.
In the title of the indicator, it implies appropriateness.
It certainly, that was a good point, but I think I'm still in the category, I think, the process. So the first question is there a need? To some extent, that is the health status indicator. That is an unmet need, the combination of a process and an outcome.
We should probably.
I assume if we deal with this later on as a process measure, we are not totally precluded from identifying some element of it as also an outcome measure. Just as we've talked of pairs here, I think we all feel there needs to be something that addresses the question of assessing the unmet need.
Of mental health problems.
It mirrors a little bit of the discussion we had yesterday with Dr. Murphy around the pediatric symptom checklist. Yeah. Trying to define need.
At least the pediatric symptom checklist was a direct indicator of, or at least intended to be a direct indicator of a health status, you know, whether you had symptoms or not, you had indicated you had.
But this says that you have a diagnosis, you have a need, you have a diagnosis.
It also says they received the care.
And so to me, if you didn't receive the care, you know, that's pretty bad. I just think that we're so used to taking mental health and taking it away from physical health that we forget, you know, you get bad outcomes if you don't get to see. If you don't see the cardiologist about your arrhythmia, you get into problems. So I'm thinking if you don't see a mental health person about your, let's say, bipolar disease, you know, you can get into problems. Of course, it might be fun to go out and spend a lot of money. I mean, but, you know, what I'm trying to say, if there is a problem there.
I guess one thing is
what I noticed in the measure specification is children who have a mental health condition and saw a mental health professional in the last 12 months. And I guess I didn't see that as meaning necessarily that they got the total care for their condition or the level of care they needed, and I saw it more as process on that point. They just got there.
There's the other issue that I think a significant proportion of mental illness is treated by primary care physicians, too. And it's ongoing as well.
So are we deferring this then to our process conversation in a couple of months?
There's a lot in here.
On the basis that one would expect that most mental health care is going to be given over time, I think process makes, I mean, I think there are elements of both, but I put it in a 60-40 process basket.
So let's defer this till our next long close meeting and conversation.
Good.
Okay, the next one is number 44. And this is children who have an adequate insurance coverage for optimal health. And the measure is designed to ascertain whether or not current insurance program coverage is adequate for the child's health needs, whether the out-of-pocket expenses are reasonable, whether the child is limited or not in choice of doctors, and whether the benefits meet the children's health care needs. So, a lot of components.
Okay,
reform.
Well, let me just say that I think this one needs to be thought about in context of health reform. And health reform is going to phase in over time, so we should be thinking about a broader time frame than just the year 2010. But I do believe that this particular set of questions need to be measured. It's really important, particularly for people who will be getting their health insurance coverage through the exchanges, and for adolescents and others who will be getting stripped down Spartan health care plans. It's very important to monitor whether those plans have an adequate scope of coverage. So whether outcome or process, this is super important in my mind.
I think you can tell by the scores up here that we have some unanimity on the importance of this measure. And I would argue that it is not a process measure. I would argue it is an outcome measure, because the flip side is you cannot have access to your health care in many instances if you don't have the capacity to pay for it. So I put it in the outcome bucket comfortably.
Also, because you have insurance doesn't mean you have access. I'm just adding that. Okay. I'm just adding that to what you said. I'm not arguing.
You're talking about mental health.
Talking about any kind of insurance, health insurance.
I feel like the patient's
better. So we think this is in scope.
Yeah, I think this is definitely in scope.
All of our efforts to expedite this conversation are not really being very productive, but that's all right. So that's in scope. And then the last one, the measure.
Medical home. So the next one, and we probably could take some time to discuss this one a little more in depth, is around the medical home. This is a measure of the medical home for children and adolescents. And it's basically a composite measure that assesses whether children and adolescents receive health care within their medical home. This is according to the survey respondent. And then it looks like there's the measure is based on 6 of 7 components that are proposed by the American Academy of Pediatrics. I think it looks like defining what the medical home is. So.
So again, I think the key question is this in scope first, is that what you wanted, and then we could, then we're going to have to prioritize which of these various ones we're going to cover during our discussion. So first question is do people feel this is an outcome measure within the scope of our deliberations?
Oh, look at the thing.
I don't see it out of scope, but I'm not sure it's in scope. I mean, it is just, you know, when you put together the start of the outcomes part, we explicitly put patient self-report on the list of outcomes. So from that perspective, I think it's potentially in.
Could I weigh in with maybe a different way of looking at it? And that is, it seems to me that currently it's an outcome, because not every child has a medical home, and we're driving in that direction. There will come a point in time where every child does have a medical home, at which point it becomes a problem.
I like that. Yeah. And I think also it's that we think we've got to think differently about medical care. And that's the problem. This is different.
Well, maybe another way of saying it is it's an intermediate outcome.
Yeah. I'm just wondering about our consistency with our unmet mental health need and whether that would also fit the same criteria, but let's not go there. So this is also clearly within scope.
And well, remember when it comes up again.
And then the last one for us to decide if it's in or out of scope would be measure 50.
Standardized development.
Yep.
That's a process.
I think that's a clear process.
Yeah, that's clearly a process.
Process.
Yay. Okay. We took care of it.
That and mental health.
Well,
mental health
is
go over the
chair. Okay, so we can pick back up. Do you think medical home would be the best one?
So I think the question is, which one do we want to pick up, and which ones do we think we have a reasonable likelihood of being able to complete within a half-hour conversation? I'm sure. Think we should be medical home and insurance?
Go for it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I won't object to that.
So let's do the insurance one first, since there was a lot of enthusiasm that I saw around me.
Expeditious.
So the insurance item is item 44. Again, does anyone, either does the steward, the way we're doing it today, have any, want to make a brief, any brief introductory comments about this item?
Sure. Well, this is one that we're particularly fond of. This comes out of the National Survey of Children's Health, and this has been used by the Maternal and Child Health Bureau and the National Center for Health Statistics for quite a while. It is a relatively new measure. It was introduced in the 2007 survey, so we're still getting publications out about it. Like a commenter on your panel said, we believe really strongly in this because even though to say whether a child has coverage or not is actually not the full picture. And so when you actually start to dive a little deeper, we do find that even among children who are reporting or the parents are reporting that there is current coverage, public or private, 15 or more percent, and it's actually much worse among private, are saying that they do not have adequate coverage based on the introduction that you gave, which is whether they have unreasonable out-of-pocket expenses, are not able to see all the providers they need, and or do not, the benefits somehow don't meet the child's needs. And so we think that's a really important story to tell, and why we're discussing it.
Great. So any other questions about importance issues on this particular question? Okay, so let's vote. How many believe this is an important item sufficient to receive?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11.
Good. So if any of them were not opposed. All right, so then the scientific validity of the items, again, I think we've reviewed the characteristics of the survey overall quite a bit. Any comments on the testing, the questions themselves, the cognitive interview of the testings, and also any assessment of these items and how they fit together, how well the algorithm works?
Well, this is, the questions are very subjective. This is parents' perception of their insurance plan, and as being subjective, it can be all over the place as what is adequate coverage. Again, somebody may perceive adequate coverage as no out-of-pocket expense, whereas somebody else may be happy with some out-of-pocket expense, and I don't know how to draw conclusions on that as to whether a child has adequate insurance. It also depends so much on the family's inherent finances and socioeconomic status.
Okay.
Let me just say that that's a point that's debated and has been for many, many years. 5% of adjusted gross income is one measure that has been used. Of course, you know, for Internal Revenue Services, use different measures. So I don't know that we're going to be able to even come close to settling that issue. It is a subjective issue.
And the way, I guess a measure to comment, measure, Stuart, can comment on this, do you recommend stratification based on vulnerability? So that may be a way to get at the issue of whether there's comparative relationship between what they would think is unreasonable and what they really have. I would actually argue that what the parents' perception is of unreasonable is unreasonable.
Yeah, I would love to comment on that, actually. Yeah. Right. In fact, this measure has so much face validity. Basically, it's an incredibly low bar. In fact, as I think you guys were discussing in a previous the measure prior to our measure, you know, there's an immense positive bias on all these questions. So all they have to do is there are the three components, whether or not the out-of-pocket costs are unreasonable, whether the plan provides for everything the child needs, and whether the benefits overall meet the child needs. And it's never, sometimes, usually, and always. This is a usually and always measure on all of them. So all you have to do is fall into the sometimes and never on one, and you become adequate, which is actually a relatively low bar. Of the three domains, it is the out-of-pocket expenses which drives a bit of it. And to give a little flavor on the stratification and the face validity, it's the private insurance, which is actually doing much worse on the overall measure and that component. You know, public insured kids are actually getting most of the expenses paid. And when you stratify by income, it is not related to income in the way you might think it is. In fact, the people doing the worst are the folks in the 200 to 400% poverty rate, which often fall outside of SCHIP, and the lowest under poverty and the highest 400% above are equal on whether or not the insurance is adequate. So it's not being driven entirely by the out-of-pocket expenses, but can be for the privately insured kids.
So, Kathy, please.
To clarify, I thought what you just said was that any of those needed to be usually or always, but the way it's written, it's a series of and statements. So you actually have to meet all the criteria. Isn't that true?
Yeah, in order to have adequate coverage, you have to be usually or always in all three of the components. And nationally, without any stratification, 15% of kids are not usually are always meeting those criteria. When I've talked to folks at the National Conference of State Legislators who we've run these numbers for and a lot of other folks, the face validity tells them they can't believe it's not significantly higher than that. Most people's personal experiences is that they can't believe everyone says they don't have adequate coverage, that they don't have adequate coverage.
This is probably a fine point, but I'm looking at the 2A2.1 calculation algorithm, and it looks to me like it's needed to see the healthcare provider. How are you handling mental health?
I'm sorry, I don't actually have the form, the mission form in front of me. Can you explain a little bit further?
Yeah, it says current insurance offers benefits or cover services that meet the child's needs.
Right.
Insurance allows the child to see needed healthcare providers. Does healthcare provider include mental health or not?
Subjective to parent interpretation.
Sorry.
And so if the coverage does not cover mental health coverage and the parent thinks it should, then they would most likely say that they were not happy with that.
All right. Do we have sufficient information to move on the scientific acceptability of the measure? I think so.
One more question.
Yes, of course, Kat.
Sorry.
Can I ask you then, what I heard you say is that there's this positive response bias and that people are shocked that if the measure does as well as it does, is there a potential unintended consequence that the problem with the positive response bias could be misleading in the opposite direction?
I'm not sure I can comment on that. We do find that in general, parents tend to be positive on everything. You know, how well are your kids doing? And, you know, if anything, we would.
Do you have kids?
I have three. Yeah, believe me, I'm always surprised on the positivity bias myself. But.
So you're saying you're not worried about that, that the families are inaccurate and that could be an unintended consequence, because what you're really saying is you're not sure they're accurate.
Yeah.
I cannot reach inside a parent's brain and understand how they perceive a question or the world around them. So.
You said 85% of parents report that their child has
adequate, right.
Meaning they meet all five of those criteria. That
right.
Their needs, and that they don't have too high out-of-pocket expenses.
Right.
Okay. And does that excludes that includes people who have no insurance at all?
No, it does not. This is of children who have current insurance, regardless of the type of insurance.
So then,
that's actually a question. It's one of the five criteria. So I assume that if they said they don't have insurance there.
That's correct. If you add back it, you can create a measure that has that, but no, this is of children with insurance.
I'm sorry, are they in the, I'm still confused, I'm sorry. Are they included or not included?
They are not included in the denominator at all. This is of children with insurance. How many have adequate or inadequate?
To me, for a child to be included in the numerator of having adequate insurance, criteria from the following five questions must be met. Child has current health insurance coverage.
That's the denominator. So if you have 5% uninsured in your community, and you then have 15% who say they had inadequate insurance, so the total would be 20% if you were speaking to the legislature, how many are, quote, underinsured in your community, you would say that would include the 15 plus 5. That would be, right?
I think that would be the right way to
Okay, scientific validity then. There's scientific acceptability. How many feel this completely meets the criteria for scientific acceptability? How many feel it partially meets the criteria?
Eight, nine, ten.
Good. Did that catch everybody?
No.
Nope.
What are you? You're minimal?
This minimal.
Okay. And that is everybody, I believe, correct?
Yeah.
We're now down to 11. All right.
All right. I think from the usability, which is how understandable this is, as well as issues of harmonization with other measures and whatever the third one is.
Added value.
Yeah. Added value. So any questions about this? If not, we'll move on to voting. To what extent does it, is it completely meet the criteria for usability? Yes. How many believe it partially meets it?
Okay, that's everybody.
And then feasibility, the Florida National Survey.
Same as all.
So how many feel it completely meets?
1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 9.
How many feel it partially?
2. Okay, that's everybody.
Good. All right, and then to move the question, recommend endorsement of this measure.
And a lot of mess, everybody.
So we got one. Now we have 14 minutes. We had to go home. Very complicated.
I would have to raise an issue here that might make our discussion a little
shorter. And that is, these were my comments on the measure.
The medical home measure.
since this survey was developed and used in this field, the definition of medical home has become multiple definitions. And I'm not sure, therefore, that this question in quite this form, these characteristics, is as timely today as it ought to be. And I don't quite know how to deal with that on a procedural basis, because I don't, you know, Kathy can't go back and rewrite their survey. But if you put this out as a standalone survey and the practice was graded very highly on this against this definition, it would not be consistent probably with the Minnesota definition of a medical home or health home. It might not be consistent with the definition that comes out of NCQA, PCPPMH, which will go, the revisions will go public next week.
But isn't that a harmonization question?
It is a harmonization question, and I don't know quite from a procedural point of view how to deal with it.
I guess maybe we discuss it
in the harmonization context.
We discuss it in the harmonization context.
And maybe since we're not going to get to it today.
I just don't think it's fair.
I wonder if our measure developer might want to look at that issue a little bit. Give us any further guidance about how completely this really would be consistent. I don't know. I just worry about conflicting standards out there.
They are different. Yeah. There really are different definitions of medical
home.
Yeah,
different definitions.
So the question might be, how well this concept maps with the joint city rules that are going to be adopted by the Primary Care Association.
We would submit that we're submitting the measure because we would like to create a national standard based on the American Academy of Pediatrics. So especially in regard to the question of, you know, does Minnesota or Oregon or California have different competing definitions, we would actually say that that's the whole reason why the national survey was devised, to measure it across states in a systematic way.
Well, I'm quite sympathetic to that, but I do think we need to have a longer conversation. So I don't think it's fair to do that in 10 minutes. And I think I might actually suggest we adjourn 10 minutes early rather than rush through.
And this might be helpful if you're going to do this measure on a subsequent phone call, perhaps for the medical developer to specifically look towards the updated medical home survey and come back with some responses or harmonizations so we're that much closer.
Right, and as long as we have the measure developer listening,
yes, of course.
Why are there any other things aside from the issue that they raised that we want to put on the table right now?
I'm sorry, was that a question?
To this group.
I, for example, would be interested in knowing from the members who sat on the SNAP CIPRA committee why this measure basically was, which was recommended to the committee to be adopted, why it was turned down, and whether there's anything that the steward could do that would help address any of the concerns that committee had. Realize that's a different process and using different criteria, but I don't know if there are any specific issues raised that would inform our further conversation.
Well, I think one of the issues that colored all of the conversations had to do with how widely the concept is used in the Medicaid and the CHIP programs currently, and the ease with which states could move to universal application in those programs.
And so the context of the recommendation here, by the way, for the medical home measure is not that these items would be used in a different context, but really, again, this is more in the context of using the national survey the way that we're using it on all the other, so as a measure of population.
Okay. Well, thank you all for plowing through as much as we could to get the day completed. I can say we certainly accomplished a lot in the past 2 days. We definitely got through a lot of these measures. Many of them were different measures than what NQF is traditionally considered looking at. So, applause and hats off to you all for getting through that information. And also thank you to Charlie and Marina for leading the discussion over the past 2 days. So quickly, next steps. I did a quick count on the tabled measures. There's about 7 of them, which in my mind and experience, I don't think we can do that on one conference call, even if it is for 2 hours. So just thinking out loud right now, I suspect we could possibly have 2 conference calls coming up. Again, we're going to work really closely with the measure developers to try and really narrow down and get down the exact items and information that you all would need to inform your decision and to expedite the process, of course. But I just want to put that on your radar. Again, we will be following up with a summary from this meeting and get your feedback on that to make sure we've captured your thoughts accurately. Also, following up on your involvement and participation with the CHIPLO project. And that is a specific deliverable as part of this project, so we will set aside time to identify gaps as well.
We're having the same issue in the various other parts of the project, getting the measures done. So a lot of what you talked about, we're capturing, and we'll probably start drafting some things for you to review and add to and all of that as we go along. But our first priority is getting through the measures.
Yeah. But as long as it's fresh in your mind, I mean,
yeah,
like, feel free to write it down.
Oh, yeah.
We'll start compiling them.
Nicole, have you got any sense of the time frame for the conference calls and when this, you want to get this part completed before we start phase 2?
That's a good question. I was looking at my calendar. I think that we'll probably give the measure developers at least 2 weeks to get this information together and, work with them. So looking at probably the last week of May, first week of June, this is just, again, off the top of my head for a call, factoring in, vacation time and holidays and that sort of thing. So we'll have to really talk about it internally because on our timeline, we are trying to go out for comment in June, so we'll have to figure out the best way to adjust our timeline and obviously meet the needs of the project.
I just wanted to express my appreciation to staff, to Nicole and Reva and your team, for all the hard work that you did. The materials were excellently presented. You did a superb job. And on behalf of the committee, I want to thank you. Couldn't have gotten as far as we can. Could without all of your hard work and the excellent preparation.
Thank you.
Where do our receipts go again?
The receipts are sent to Leslie Reeder Thompson. I can forward you her information, yes. The receipts, and I believe there's a form that has to be filled out.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Travel safely. And thank you all very, very much.
So what's next?
I'm thinking out loud. The 92-week call up with Mr. Dahlberg to get that stuff cleared up and maybe have a call. Maybe. Sometimes
it's a
good
idea. So they're
I'm going on vacation. And so,
things in their mind.
Yeah, I'm thinking it'll be early June, probably the first of the week.
Well, I feel like they're as hard as you. And what we typically do is we've gotten a number of.
We've been given the end of the year.
So, you know.
I forget. I'm terrible with names.
Hello, Chris. Chris, the meeting is over.